The History Things podcast is brought to you by History Net, publisher of 9 different historical magazines, including the Civil War Times, American History, and Military History. Visit historynet.com to learn more or follow them on social media by searching for @history_net. Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy the show.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy. That bomb has more power than 20,000 tons of TNT.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the History Things podcast. I am your co-host, Pat McGuire, coming to you live from the War Department studio, a new War Department studio. I don't even know if it's 2.0, 3.0, doesn't matter. We just keep revitalizing, revamping. I don't know. We're like Steve Jobs and Apple. We got a new version. When you think you know the History Things podcast, it's time to upgrade. Joining me today in the studio, as always, is my co-host with the most, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, ghouls and goblins. If you stayed with us from our Halloween episode last year, we can't get off that one. I am joined by my co-host with the most. You know him, you love him, guys. Author, historian, park ranger, magician, possibly an astronaut at this point. Ladies and gentlemen, Matt Borders, Matty B. Welcome back to the History Things podcast.
Well, thank you, Pat. I don't know where those last two came from, but I guess I'll take it.
I haven't seen you in a while. I just assume you've been training for outer space.
There is that. And honestly, the way the War Department is looking, we might as well be NASA over here.
How does this feel to
the
you?
The NASA podcast.
How does this feel to be in our new...
Oh, it's amazing. Amazing. I was glad to help where I could, but the work that you've done in your down period has been fantastic.
Yeah, I'm
absolutely
very excited
phenomenal.
To be here. We obviously lived in the War Department studio for a couple of years, built by our good friend Eric Mone. I guess with assistance. I helped, Matt helped, Parker helped. There were a lot of hands, but we were at the direction of our good friend Eric Mone. And after living in that space for a few years, doing 2 seasons of the show, we figured out what worked for us and what wasn't. So we made some changes, and honestly, we hope that the vibe reaches your ears the way that it feels for us in this room, and we hope that our guests have as good a time in this room as we do. And let's get right to it, because our special guest today
is a very special guest.
He's a very special person to us. He's one of our dearest friends. And if you've been with the History Things podcast in season one, which was how many years ago, Matt?
Five
years ago. Then you will know this person. This person was one of our earliest guests, actually guest number 2 outright. So knocking around the first base runners was this big bat. And then they actually were part of one of the most special episodes that I got to do for our show as a producer, the September 11th memorial episode we did.
And one of our earliest from the fields.
Yes. And then I was going to say, and then we did the Ghoul Fest. We did the very first Halloween extravaganza with our good mate. Of course, I am just tiptoeing around the fact that we have our legendary friend Avery Lentz joining us in the War Department studio again. Avery, how are you, buddy? It's great to see you. It's great to personally see you. I haven't seen you in a while, but it's great to have you back behind the microphones. How are you?
Oh, I am happy to be back, Pat, and thank you and Matt and our editor Parker here for having me back. It has been a long time, hasn't it?
It's been a super long time.
Like, I don't think I saw you at all last year, did I?
I think we were physically in the same... Yes, we were.
Yes,
we were at
Hartwig's,
because we were both, let's just name drop. Can we name drop at this
point? Sure
we were all at Scott Hartwig's book release party. And I definitely saw you there. And that was, what, September?
So my memory is not what it used to be.
No, I mean,
so
look,
you're probably
going to
regret having me on this show.
Never regret having you on the show. Sometimes the parents of our listeners regret when we have you on because you, like me, curse like a hockey player. But
yes, I sure
at the end of the day, brother, who cares? And just for your ear muffing, if you're freaking out right now because you're like, ah! Don't worry. We're not coming at you hockey energy. We might come at you hockey energy, but not hockey language tonight. Because when we get to it in a minute, we actually have a pretty big topic tonight. One that is not just deserving of great reverence in general when we discuss it, but one that also, you know, we personally keep a reverence for. I know that you, Avery, when we pitched it to you to come on the show and talk about this, you were like, yes, dude, like this is one of your jams. And what we look for is passionate.
And the prep work that he's putting into this episode is wild.
We're going to get to that in a minute. But like what we look for in guests is people that are going to be passionate about the subject. And we know that outside of Star Wars and a few other things, tonight's subject gets the gears going. And Jesus. You are very well prepared for it. Matt, Avery, Avery has the master copy, Matt, myself, and our producer, Parker, the ambassador from Maine, as he's recently been dubbed, we'll share more about the new studio in our mid-year in a couple weeks, I guess, because this will be April when you're listening. So in June, when that comes out, we'll talk more about it. But with the redone studio, Maine officially has an embassy in it, and Parker has been named its ambassador. But all of us are sitting there holding these really well put together packets of maps and things like that so that we can follow along with this epic story. So tonight, Matt, we have covered a lot on the History of Things podcast. We have talked about the American Civil War. That's was our wheelhouse at the beginning. We've gone to the front lines, the trenches of the First World War. We've been in the seas and sky of that same war. We've been to the Crimea. We've talked about a lot. Shipwrecks.
Disasters. Industry.
Yep. We've talked about quite a bit of information and subject material on this show here. But we have stayed away from one of the more popular subjects. And I was thinking about what I wanted to say about this last night, and I think the simple
thing did it on purpose.
Yeah, it's not like we enjoy the subject, we engage in it, but it's not like the interpreter in us is nowhere near ready for that yet. So what we did was we needed to find the right voice, and we knew that, like we just said a minute ago, that our friend, our passionate friend here, has one of those voices. So tonight we are finally going to be discussing World War II.
Right.
Here on the History of Things podcast. And what we decided we're going to do for you, our listeners, is since this is such a big topic and it's our first time getting into it, we're not going to cover like in every little, what we're going to do is we're going to take a 30,000 foot view and we're going to go through the theaters. We're going to stay, we're going to get in a nice, safe B-29, B-25, whatever you want to fly. But what we're going to do is stay at 30,000 or so feet. And we're going to look down on this and we're going to pick a theater. And since the war basically starts, if you consider the total years of military action, that is the Second World War, we're going to start in the Pacific.
Absolutely.
With the action that begins over there in the mid to late 1930s. So Avery.
Yes, Patrick.
I have been excited to do this episode since the minute you said yes. Every day since then, I've been like, is today the day we're recording it? Like, are we ready today? I am so fired up for this, dude. So thank you for coming on the show. Let's get into the Pacific. Are you ready?
I am ready.
You ready to
take a
beach?
You know how to make a brown man blush. You're just so flattering.
Red right now.
I'm flustered.
I thought
a
it was the light in the room, but now that I see it, are.
It's also a lot of pressure on me. But no,
no pressure.
No, the Pacific has always been kind of a passion project for me. I mean, Matt knows and you know I'm a Civil War historian by trade, but I wrote my undergraduate capstone as part of the Pacific War. I studied Okinawa. That was my senior thesis in undergrad, was on the civilian perspectives and experience on Okinawa and how that deserved a defining chapter of the Okinawa narrative, because you only ever got the American narrative or the Allied narrative, or in some cases, the Japanese narrative, because I was actually looking at Japanese like textbooks and how they remembered the battle and stuff. And what I noticed was that whether you were Japanese or American, nobody wanted to be the bad guy. Well, if you were an Okinawan, everyone was a bad guy.
Right.
You
know, they aren't Japanese.
They never considered themselves Japanese.
Right.
They're considered a Japanese prefecture today, the Ryukyus, the whole Ryukyu Island chain, but Okinawans have their own identity. And unfortunately, that identity was stolen from them by the Japanese Empire. And during the Okinawa campaign, and if you're familiar with the Pacific War, you know that it's the climactic battle. It's what kind of caps off all the island hopping in the Pacific. And not only is it one of the most climactic battles of the war, it is the bloodiest for the Pacific at the very least. And we'll get to that more in depth, but that's where I really wanted to like develop more of an understanding of this conflict. I'd always been kind of more interested in the Pacific when it came to World War II. Yeah. I mean, you can't ignore Europe. You can't ignore D-Day. You can't ignore, the liberation of the European continent and the fall of Nazi Germany. But for me, I don't know. The Pacific, I think, was always more of a draw for me because I, A, love the tropics, and the Pacific's full of them. And I would say that of all the conflicts in American military history, that is probably our most challenging war, because you just don't realize how much logistics, how much manpower, how much strategy has to go into waging a war over the largest body of water on this planet. And the fact that you're fighting over specks of land that you've never heard of against a tough and determined enemy, and that's putting it lightly. And I think for me, as I got older, what was a really big draw and what set the Pacific off a little different from Europe especially was just the brutality of it and the racial ideologies that accompanied that brutality.
Right.
Now, obviously, in Europe, you know, the persecution of the Jews and other ethnic groups, that's something we can't ignore. But in the Pacific, it was just a whole different level. I don't know how else to describe it.
And not just in the Pacific, because also stateside, right? Like, we interacted stateside with the Pacific theater very differently. And that's simply put, if it looks different from you, it's easier to vilify, demonize, do whatever. And Japanese people look different than most, you know, white Americans. Yeah. So
let's do a quick around the room. You had relative in the Pacific, didn't you, Avery?
So my father's father, my paternal grandfather, was a African American who joined the Navy, and this is at a time of segregation. So, he's joining the segregated Navy in 1943 because he was drafted. And he became a CB.
Nice,
so he
That's cool.
was an engineer that built artificial harbors on all these islands. And he was he basically loaded torpedoes. So it's not like I'm saying he did everything himself because, you know, it was awesome. But
I think what I heard was your grandfather won the war.
Yeah, he won the war single-handedly. Well, someone had to build those airfields and those harbors, man.
It takes everyone.
It does. He never really saw action or combat. But I got to tell you, you don't have to be a combatant to see action in the Pacific,
right?
Especially considering you get from point A to point B by riding a ship or flying a plane. And all it takes is one bad day for you to have a really worst day.
Yeah, have your worst day.
Worst couple of days in the cases of some of these shipwreck survivors. But yeah, that's what's, I think, so anxiety-riddling about it is just how there's not really a, you can't, it's, I think someone said once when looking at the Pacific, they're like, you know, in Europe, our armies, if they got into trouble, if our forces got into trouble, they could retreat, they could fall back. Whereas in the Pacific, you get into trouble.
We had Australia.
I mean, it's hard for a naval fleet to withdraw. You know, they can't just run away.
Well, before we get into it and spoil too much, that was the whole point, was they, when the United States was attacked, it was attacked with the intention of crippling it that it couldn't even get across, knowing how string thin its presence was in the Pacific. So
Pat, did you have family in the Pacific?
I do. I actually had two definite and one just missed it. My great-grandfather served in both World Wars, seemingly as a chaplain. Doing research on him currently right now, don't know a lot, but I inherited recently his trunk, which is very clearly labeled as chaplain. And then some of his medals would indicate from both wars. It's without getting into the messy dynamics of family, I was fortunate to grow up with three sets of grandparents because of a divorce on one side of the family. So my grandfather, one of my other grandfathers, was a Navy pilot, who was actually part of the stories we're going to talk about tonight.
Oh, wow.
Got to see the bombing of Tokyo from right above it as it was happening. was engaged in dogfights with Japanese Zeros. Pretty sure was in the Battle of Midway. Mm. We're not going to hear her talk about it, but so there was that. And then my other grandfather, the son of the chaplain, just missed it. Like, just, like, went down and, like, tried to lie in recruiting about age. And they were like, nah, fam. But stayed in the Guard, served in Korea as soon as that story came around, which I know Korea is another thing you like to talk about. So at some point, when we do Korea, maybe we'll get you involved in that somehow. Maybe we'll do it from the field from Korea.
Oh, my God. That would be amazing.
We'll go to North Korea and figure out what's up.
We'll go get
our shit back.
Going to Seoul. Going to Seoul, South Korea is like on my bucket list. So,
yeah, I would definitely like to go. I would like to see the DMZ.
And they've actually preserved a lot of the battlefields there.
Very cool.
We'll stay on this war.
Yeah, so let's go to...
Wait, Matt, did you say anything you had?
Oh, yeah.
My grandfather, actually.
Oh.
He was in the Pacific. He was a CB.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, CBs.
Were they on the same ship?
No.
Probably not. Right,
probably not. He went in
if they were on the same ship, they didn't speak.
Right. He went in 43 to avoid the draft. Yeah. He was older. He was like 35 when he enlisted.
So he volunteered.
Yeah, okay. Because he wanted to avoid the draft and choose where he wanted to go. Mm-hmm. He was already a mechanic, and so he joined up with the CBs and built airstrips, just like you were saying, Avery. Yeah. And
so
and
my grandfather was building harbors. Your grandfather was building airstrips.
Yep.
Matt and I won this war.
At least the bloodlines did.
Our blood.
And then, he's going to be heavily involved in the Marshall Islands campaign.
Oh, very good. Very good.
Yeah, I got to see my one grandfather's flight log once, and it was pretty... His commentary on what he witnessed flying above Tokyo as it went up in flames was pretty wild.
Oh, I can imagine.
Just talking about... He tried to write, like, every few minutes, and he would timestamp it, and seeing how quick the timestamps were, it was like, well, that... entire neighborhood's gone. It's like, oh my goodness. So let's get into it, right? So when we think of the Second World War, we very conveniently like to go to Europe. We think about D-Day. We think about movies like Saving Private Ryan. Yeah. We think about shows like Band of Brothers, a lot of other films. If you're part of the older generation, you're screaming at me right now because I didn't mention specific films like The Battle of the Bulge.
Longest Day,
things like
Bridge
that.
Bridge Too Far,
yeah, yep.
Yeah. Even some of the more fun ones, Kelly's Heroes, you know, stuff like that. We didn't, whatever. But we seem to go to Europe, and when we go to the Pacific, we don't really ever get too deep into the subject. We typically stay around Pearl Harbor because that's a very digestible story, and the way we like to tell stories in this country, that's one that's very we got victimized. We got hit. I mean, we got straight up. There's no gray to that. We just got sucker punched.
Yeah.
And we're all pissed about it.
Oh, man.
So we typically stay about that. But we know that the years of the war are not just from that moment in 1941 till the inevitable surrenders in 45 for both Eastern and Pacific theaters, right? So the traditional thought would be, it's 1941 to 1945. We know that in the Pacific, it starts much earlier. So, Avery, the Pacific War begins in your storytelling where?
Oh, absolutely. The invasion of Manchuria. That occurs in 1932. But before I even get there, let's go further back a bit.
Matt, hit the time machine. Hit the button.
Actually.
You don't need to do the sound effects, Mark. Avery did it.
But ironically, let's start with the First World War. Because I think a lot of people don't know. No offense to non-historians out there, because honestly, it wasn't even really taught. But Japan was on our side.
Darn straight.
That's right, ally.
They were an ally.
Punched Germany in the face.
They kept German colonial interests occupied in the Pacific while we were slugging it out on the Western Front. And I think that's very important to the story because this is at a time when Japan is coming into the world stage as a major world power. And they're doing so through their naval power. It very much is something that I think is very interesting because a lot of the nations that are going to fight in World War I and II, they're going to get a hold of a very important book. A book that was written by an American.
Yep.
An American by the name of Alfred Thayer Mahan. And that was The Influence of Sea Power. And it was literally in the war rooms of every single major nation at the turn of the 20th century. And Japan was one of those nations. And Japan says, oh, I like this. I like this a lot. This is a great idea. Let's build the largest naval fleet the world's ever seen. And, I mean, it doesn't sound so far-fetched. They're an island nation, a nation of islands surrounded by water. Of course they're going to have a large navy. Of course they're going to develop that. And the thing is, unfortunately, being Japanese, being from the Far East, a lot of the Western nations are going to underestimate greatly Japan's ability to create such fleets, to even hold their own against Western nations. And in the case of the Russians in the Russo-Japanese War, and that's 1904-05, right? Correct?
Somewhere there.
Somewhere around that. So this is... Yeah, 1905. Okay. So it's at the Battle of Tsushima during that war that Japan is going to illustrate to the Western world just how capable they are at raising a fleet that can do significant damage. They literally destroy the entire Russian fleet at anchor in Tsushima Bay, and they did it by a surprise attack. They did it in the morning. They did it in a foggy morning without warning. Does this sound familiar?
Very familiar.
So remember that, class. Remember Tsushima.
Right.
But sushi. The point is...
Not sushi. Tsushima.
Yeah, Tsushima. And so, oh, that's another thing tonight. So I'm going to say a lot of Japanese names, both people and places, and I'm going to try my best not to butcher them. So for anyone out there that is sitting and waiting for me to just mispronounce something,
they're waiting, dude.
Piss off. I'm doing my waiting. Best.
They emailed us before we even announced this episode, because as the time we're recording this, people don't even know, but somebody figured out, and they were like, dude, as soon as Avery butchers it, I'm on it.
Yeah.
To be fair, they've been listening. To be fair, they've been listening to me butcher French for the last four seasons.
In that case, I don't care.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Is like on this show by season five, like us butchering a language is not new territory.
Yes, but
Japan, you're welcome. You're finally part of the club of butcher languages on our show.
I'm going to do my best, Japan. Any Japanese listeners out there?
I hope they
respect your culture.
I hope they feel honored by our terrible.
I want to go. I want to go to Tokyo too, and I love Godzilla Minus One. By the way, anyway.
Great film.
It
great
is an awesome film, Pat. It's actually a compliment.
I haven't seen any other Godzilla film to get other an Oscar than nomination. The originals and the Matthew Broderick one.
You got to see this one.
Yeah, you do.
But to get
you
back really on topic. Do. Get back on topic.
Right, well, Nick Tatopoulos.
Getting back on topic, Japan at the end of World War I, you know, we're fast forwarding from the Russo-Japanese War to the end of World War I. Japan has become a major world power with its naval abilities. And even with its assistance in achieving a victory against the Central Powers, Japan kind of gets snubbed at the peace tables. Not they definitely do.
Oh, yeah. And they get sent to the kids' table.
Yeah. They literally get sat at the kids' table, and there is no reason for it. The excuses, as I call them, excuses that, you know, countries like Great Britain and the United States and France, they're basically like, well, you know, you didn't do that much. You
didn't die on the Western Front in mass.
Pretty much. Yeah. And also their gains did not have a lot of strategic value in the eyes of the Allies.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they do grab a couple islands. They get the Caroline Islands out of that. They're also going to get some of the Marshall Islands and even some of the Gilbert Islands.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask if some of these land grabs are going to be lands we're fighting over.
Exactly. These are important islands. I guarantee you in the 1910s and 1920s, nobody knew anything about these places, at least in the United States. Everyone's looking at Europe. No one is even concerned with the Pacific. No one's even thinking about Japan being out there and ever being a problem. It's just another world. It's another dimension almost. They just don't care.
Right.
And I think the biggest slap in the face for Japan is going to come at the 1923 Naval Conference in Washington, D.C. It's where all the Western powers are going to start putting sanctions on how large your fleets can be. You know, everyone's got to be on the same page. And that's very interesting because Japan gets slapped with a ton of sanctions. And it's because at this point, you know, obviously we see all the dreadnoughts coming out of World War One. Well, Japan creates a massive fleet and it rivals a lot of the Western powers' fleets in terms of size, in terms of armaments. And that causes a lot of hearts to flutter and pearls to be clutched in DC. And so Japan is basically told you're going to have to limit the size of your navy. And they're asking why, and they're like, "You're just gonna have to." That's part of the conference, and I'm not gonna get too in depth with it, but I can three guesses why Japan gets singled out of all the other white nations at the naval conference. And so, yes, Matt, what did you like?
It's ironic though, because just before 1900, the Tsar Nicholas II had proposed the same thing. There was a naval conference in Europe because he was really worried about the armament race going on, particularly between Germany.
Before there were nukes. There
between Germany and England. Yeah. But he's very concerned about his own fleet, the one that's going to get
get murked
Tsushima.
At Tsushima, yes.
Yeah. Murked it. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Mm-hmm. But
can we get sushi when this is over?
I'd love some. I'm actually kind of in the mood. Anyway, continue.
He attempts to restrict naval development as well, and he's ignored, almost laughed out of the room. So it's interesting that Europe and the United States and everybody is now on that page of, okay, limitations, especially you, limitations.
Well, yes, because, especially you, Japan.
That's because when Nikki the Deuce was, for you, my favorite fan, Mark out there, who hates when I do that, when Nicholas II was suggesting these things, it was clear that the cookie was crumbling.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. All over that empire.
That's definitely
true.
So
people were like, oh, great suggestion coming from somebody who can't keep control of his own place.
Yeah,
you're not wrong.
Who cares, dude? So it makes sense that when it becomes convenient for them later, it's not exactly apples to apples. Everybody's looking at Nicholas with all this. It's like, by the way, you're getting blown away by everybody else in that arms race, too. Not only are you losing control of things at home, but you're also getting passed by everybody militarily. Suck it!
Yeah. And another thing with this 1923 naval conference, because of these sanctions, Japan's like, oh, well, and here's our rebuttal. Go F yourselves. We're walking, deuces.
Right.
And
they
just walk out. And they're like, we're not going to be a part of this. If you're going to continue to treat us like that, we're not going to be a part of it. You're not going to tell us how large our Navy can be and how advanced it can be. Go F yourselves.
Right.
So they leave. And as the 1920s and 1930s take off, and mostly for the rest of the 1920s, places that Japan had gotten a lot of its resources from, other places in, say, the Dutch East Indies,
right,
in Indochina, and British colonies like Singapore and Hong Kong. And, and
clearly,
you know,
you've never been to Singapore.
Nicely done.
Thanks. And the Philippines, which is an American territory at the point of something or other.
Hey, Matt knows about the Philippines.
Spain and war.
Ultimately,
that's right,
they start getting restrictions on certain resources they can bring home. And if it's not restrictions, they're being heavily taxed for it. It's just, it's very clear that the West has kind of a grudge, or at least an axe to grind, with Japan because of them leaving the conference, because it's kind of a he said, she said kind of thing, where it's basically blaming Japan for walking out of the conference. Well, Japan's like, well, we walked out because you guys were being jerks.
Yeah, like, dude,
so
you're
like,
being mean.
Yeah, you're being,
to
like,
me.
Clearly this is about something else, you know.
Right.
So, like, right, you know, but so because of that, Japan is saying, look, we need resources. We're an island nation. We have to keep our supplies going. But at the same time, you know that imperialism thing that everyone was super into in the 1910s and went to war over? Let's do that.
Like, that sounds kind of hot.
Let's get into,
like, that's
that,
a
you know?
Vibe, dude.
And part of Japan's whole, like, prestige was selecting themselves, at least in the Far East, as, like, the nation, as the people. They are the one race that's going to basically bring a new period of enlightenment to the Far East. And this is another word for that is kind of fascism, a little bit. but it's very interesting because Japanese fascism, I would say it's more ultranationalism. Whereas, you know, obviously it's definitely fascism in Germany, definitely fascism in Italy, but this is that time period that this is happening. While some people, like the United States, are becoming isolationists, Japan is saying, no, this is our moment. We got to, like, step onto the world stage. We have to prove to them that we're not going to be bullied. We're not going to be bullied out of conferences. We're not going to be bullied out of our trade routes and our shipping routes and our economic trades. Like, we have to stand up for ourselves.
Right, because Japan's like, listen, you bullied us into opening our doors, and we did, and you will bully us no more.
Yes, indeed. So by the 1930s, there has just been this massive rise of ultranationalism in Japan. And the military especially is going to be kind of just popping off with this ideology. But it should be noted that for Japan, it's not as clear cut and dry as people think it is, because the Japanese Navy and the Japanese Army, two very different entities, are almost in a state of civil war. Mm. They are extreme rivals at this point, a team of rivals, if you will. but they are going to have a lot of consternation with one another. And because of that, there is a kind of power grab in Japan amongst the military leaders. So like who gets more resources, who gets more funding, the Navy, the Army, the Navy. It goes back and forth like that for most of the 1920s into the 1930s. And part of the issues they're running into is these, you know, the restrictions on supplies from, you know, these other Western powers, like the French in Indochina, the Brits in their colonies, the Dutch in their colonies, and then to an extent the Australians and Americans as well. So yes, Matt, what do you want to add?
Avery, I'm curious, not having much background in the Japanese military structure, do we see a lot of royalty or upper class in the high ranks of, like, you see that a lot in Europe.
Yeah.
Like admirals in particular tend to be kings or you'll have these monarchs with honorifics in the military, in their
the
militaries,
nobles.
The nobility and such like that. Are you seeing that in Japan during this period?
I would say to an extent, not as large as Europe, but there are definitely higher class elements, in the high ranking positions within military. Obviously, they have the imperial structure, they have the emperor, and it's something that's very critical. The emperor is God, duty to God.
Like that, literally
that
God.
Is, literally
is,
God.
That is
yeah.
their deity. They worship that emperor. Whatever he says is that's
like
that's
the physical manifestation of God on
pretty
earth.
Pretty much. He is a conduit of God.
Okay.
And he's a fairly young man too
in the war.
So
yes.
Ruling by divine right.
Yes. Yes. And by the time we're going into like late 1930s, early 1940s, you know, Hirohito, Emperor Hirohito, who I'm going to mention multiple times. He is kind of trying to keep control of the situation, but it's with this rise of ultranationalism, he's finding it very hard to control the military. So he kind of has to play politics. He's got to play buddy-buddy with a lot of these kind of crazy alt-right Japanese military leaders. And
right.
I think part of the situation that kind of deepens that is going to be this lack of resources that they are getting. Or this kind of the sanctions that are being leveled on them before they even invade China.
Okay.
And that's, and on that note, we're going to segue to it. So like I said, I do believe the war... Second World War, the conflict that will become a global crusade and crucible for the
conflagration.
I like crucible. That's
right.
A global crucible. Anyway,
Ian Toll calls it a crucible in one of his books.
Yep.
It's the first one.
That's right.
And that's for the record. I did the readings. Prior to this, I was doing research on trilogy. Just a quick plug. You got, Pacific Crucible is part one, Conquering Tides part two, and Twilight of the Gods is part three. This is a trilogy, great overview, mostly from a naval perspective. So if you want to read anything on the Pacific, that's where I would start. You want the Army's perspective, then John C. McManus's U.S. Army in the Pacific trilogy, that's Fire and Fortitude, and Island Infernos, and To the End of the Earth.
All right.
So there's two trilogies of books that you should read.
We have the Ian Toll trilogy sitting right over there.
I did.
In the main embassy's book vault over there.
Nice.
It's my book, but it sits behind Parker, so technically it's in the embassy.
It's in Maine right now.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
God, I got to ask them back for that. All right.
Yes, but the war itself initially, in my opinion, begins in Japan's Kwangtung Army, all like 4 million of them. Are going to invade Manchuria, which is, of course, the northern China. And that's an attempt to grab oil, grab copper, any other natural resources from the region. And they're going to justify it in part of their imperial destiny. And literally, that's where you see Mahanagan. They're saying, hey, he said it. It's that destiny we were supposed to expand, you know? And we're just going off what this American guy wrote, you know?
Right.
And I'm like, you can't fault him for that. However... This is where I'm
You're taking it too literally.
This is where I'm going to, it's going to get harder and harder for me to defend Japan here because, you know, for the first 5 years here from 32 to 37, the fighting in Manchuria, it's brutal, rough, but, you know, they are still somewhat within, you know, the level of, okay, we're still civilized and whatnot.
Bounds of warfare.
Yeah. And to make things kind of more complicated for Japan, at least the story, what's going on behind the lines? So there are multiple assassination attempts of Japanese military and political leaders by this ultra-nationalist faction in Japan. Tokyo is a dangerous place to live if you are in the high-ranking commands of either the Navy or the Army or any kind of the political spectrums there. The Diet, which is Japanese Congress, they're basically
you know, if you don't play ball with the ultra nationalists, you're getting shot.
Wow.
Or you're getting murdered. Like, they're breaking into your house at night and slitting your throat. Like, it's brutal. And so this is all happening as they're trying to understand, you know, or trying to justify this war, this invasion of Manchuria. And they're basically saying, one side saying, we're not going to expand this. We're just getting resources here because we're forced to do this. They made us do this. They being the Western power. And so just to kind of illustrate just how wonky everything is, May of 1932, there is a regiment from the same army, the Kwangtung Army. They're going to stage a mutiny in Tokyo. They're going to seize multiple congressional buildings and military outposts throughout the city. And they're basically going to do this on the belief that the ultranationalists are gaining too much power and that they need to be stopped. And they're being sent to Manchuria on an unjust war.
A Japanese regiment
is doing this.
That's wild.
That is wild. So
they all got killed by the emperor.
Well, so Emperor Hirohito basically comes along and is like, guys, I'm going to need you to disperse.
Because I'm going
to
kill the shit out of you.
No, not even him. That's the thing is that, you know, Emperor Hirohito is like, look, guys, I see what you're doing. I get there's a threat, but well, you need to disperse. So they disperse and then they get murdered.
Okay, I was going to say, because there's no way that doesn't happen.
They either end up in prison or they end up dead. So it's there's a lot going on behind the scenes. And this is a great segue into probably one of the more critical figures of the Japanese military. That's going to be Isoroku Yamamoto.
Mm.
And
dude, that you're a pro. I don't think you're butchering any of this. That was confident. It sounded right.
Yeah, you know, I'm trying my best.
Good job, things. Brother.
But yes, Yamamoto is going to be Japan's Navy Secretary for most of the 1930s. And he's actually in stark contrast to his other fellow naval officers because this guy, Yamamoto, is doing everything he possibly can to fix relations, not just between the Navy and the Army in Japan, but with other nations, particularly the United States of America.
America. Mm-hmm.
Because he's actually spent a lot of time in the United States. He actually worked at the Japanese embassy in D.C., I believe, in the 1920s. Don't quote me on that. I'm not entirely sure. But needless to say, he has spent time in America.
He was a naval attaché.
He knows American naval personnel. He's talked with them. And he's not the only one to do this. I mean, there's a lot of Japanese admirals and generals who are going to be conversing with a lot of American admirals and generals. And like basically, you know, knowing how the other works. And basically, Yamamoto is saying, without a doubt, it would be a grave mistake for Japan to go to war with the United States.
Like, don't do it. He's saying, homie,
he's
don't
saying
do it.
Absolutely not. He's like, look, we might be able to run wild for about 6 months in the Pacific.
You would have to defeat them.
We'd have to
totally
defeat them totally within 6 to 7 months. After that, their industrial might, they being the United States, and their sense of pride in its armed forces would lead to a destructive and prolonged war. Yamamoto is saying this in the 1930s, and he is urging everyone in the congressional levels, as well as the military leadership of Japan's armed forces, basically, guys, we need to be careful. And if we're going like, into this conflict,
don't do this.
Don't poke a bear.
Don't do this.
Yeah, the United States is a bear. Don't poke it. And so it's actually Yamamoto is famously going to say that he, you know, going to be able to, he's going to say we're going to, you know, clobber America, but then they're going to push back at us and they're going to get us in a series of island hopping campaigns. Like, it's eerie how on point he is with his prediction.
They should have listened to him.
And he really should have. But here's the thing. They almost kill him. You know, most of the Imperial Navy High Command believed that, you know, they could lure the U.S. Pacific Fleet into another Tsushima style battle. You know, bring them to the home islands of Japan and then blow them to hell there. But Yamamoto is correctly predicting the U.S. is it's not going to do that. They're not going to come all the way to our islands in the beginning of the war. They're going to be cautious.
They may be hee-haws, but they're not dumb.
Stupid. Yeah. And so, you know, Yamamoto's critics, they're going to accuse him of being anti-patriotic. And so he's even going to he's going to receive some death threats from these ultra-nationalist factions. Eventually, by 1940, he's going to be reassigned. He will lose the job of the Secretary of the Navy in Japan, and he's going to be assigned as the commander of the Japanese Combined Fleet.
Isn't it crazy how doing patriotic things gets you accused of being unpatriotic?
Yeah.
Like, and that's not just isolated to this moment in time or our current moment in time. It's like
not just for our nation.
The perceptions of patriotism are always like just skewed.
Yeah, it's pretty. I feel for the guy, I do, because and a lot of people go like, "Oh, you're sympathetic to the guy that orchestrated Pearl Harbor," and I'm like, "Listen,
Yes. Like, I mean, no, it was a joke. Listener who's mad, that was a joke.
Listen. It's easy for us to villainize the enemy, obviously. You know, it's easy to be biased, but I think to understand this conflict, you got to understand enemies. And in Japan's case, not everyone is out for blood against Americans. In Tsuruko Yamamoto's case, he's doing his duty. He believed that even if you don't like the job you're doing, you got to do it. He's an admiral. He's a sailor. He's a Navy man to a T. You know, he's going to do his duty.
And do you think he also wants to really, maybe a little part of him, because he is such a career Navy man, wants to kind of see how, let's see how we
absolutely.
Do.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Can,
I mean, you
can
know,
we do this?
And I think that's the thing. It's like, we haven't had the opportunity to prove ourselves in a prolonged war, but he is ultimately knowing, like, we don't have the resources to last or outlast the Americans.
Right.
You know, they have the industry. We don't. We're an island nation. They're a continental nation. They have more people, they have more warehouses, blah, 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 blah. And you know, Yamamoto can see that. But nevertheless, he's going to do his job. He's going to basically get the mantle of combined fleet commander, and he is going out to sea. And to be fair, he's safer out at sea because people are still trying to kill him.
It sounds like Tokyo is pretty dangerous.
Tokyo is a dangerous place if you're an outspoken critic of the far right. So, yeah, there's that to think about. And then here's another thing we got to consider. Like I said, Navy and the Army in Japan are at each other's throats. A lot of people like Yamamoto, you know, they're believing that with tensions reaching a height around 1937, it seemed like Japan was almost going to go to war with itself, that there was going to be a civil war between these two branches of the military.
Like between the Army and the Navy?
Yes. And so
I wonder how that would work.
Yamamoto and a lot of
get in their boats and just stay in the ocean. They're like, come get us, Army.
Well, at some point, those things will have to meet. Because there's these things called ports anyway. But so, I mean, there's definitely things.
Everybody's out of gas. Yeah. The boats don't have it because they didn't bring it. The Army's out of gas. And Japan's just sitting there like, this sucks.
Yeah, pretty much. But, I mean, Eugene W. Toll, being a naval historian, he made the point that it's like it almost seemed like they believed going to war with the globe was a way of avoiding a civil conflict in the nation. So
that's an interesting concept.
It is very interesting. And in 1937, the conflict will grow because now, by July of 1937, we see the official invasion of China, the mainland China. And it is, from the get-go, a brutal fight. You have the Marco Polo Bridge incident, which just becomes the Battle of Beijing. And it very quickly seems like Japan, the Japanese forces, Kuomintang Army, they're able to seize a lot of these port cities very quickly, but they cannot push inland. And China is a very interesting enemy because China has got two different factions as well. You got Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist forces. They basically run most of the government. They have more men. They have more material. They're also going to take a heavier bloody nose than their other faction, their counterparts, the Chinese communists under Mao Zedong. And so with these factions, that's, you know, the Chinese communists, Chinese nationalists kind of undermining one another, that's going to be one advantage the Japanese military has. However, they don't have the manpower or the resources to push inland, so they can just grab the ports. Japanese Navy comes into play, and the rest of the world is watching at this point because this is...
Are they watching, like, just going like, wow, or are they going like, oh, God?
I think it's more of a wow at this point.
Interesting, but irrelevant.
We haven't had the invasion of Poland yet, Patrick, at this point.
No,
so.
I know this.
No, I'm just kidding.
I know what year it is in our chat.
1937. So, yeah, I think there was less, like, of a reaction as opposed to the invasion of Poland, but... nevertheless, I mean, this is considered the second Sino-Japanese war.
This is also a year after the Olympics in Berlin. Exactly. So like people around the world are tense because everybody just saw up close and personal what Hitler's government and people in military are going to look like. And now they're like, oh no, something entirely different just happened.
And it should be noted that by this point, Hitler and Emperor Hirohito and the Prime Minister Hideki Tojo have all met, and they have all discussed, and they are all doing such and such, you know, creating future partnerships.
Exactly what I was going to ask about.
Yep. So, I mean, this has happened by then. There are going to be German observers going along with the Japanese army as they go into China. And here's where things get interesting. And by interesting, I mean really dark. In December of 1937, one particular city that the Japanese army reaches is Nanjing.
Nanjing. Yes. Sorry, yes.
No worries.
I butcher languages too.
I know.
Gosh. It's not just Avery.
Say it again though, Avery.
Nanjing. So Nanjing. Okay. I-N-G. Ooh, I'm becoming Chinese. Anyway, but no, Nanjing is going to be the city that becomes synonymous with massacre, becomes synonymous with its nickname of the incident. It's not even a battle. I mean, there was a battle of Nanjing, but they also called it the Rape of Nanjing.
Right.
Just to give you some stats, by the end of a 6-week battle in the city, there were 200,000 dead Chinese soldiers and civilians. You had almost, and really rough, between 20,000 to 80,000 rapes.
Oh my God. Wow.
In 6 weeks.
Jesus Christ.
And then also 30,000 to 40,000 prisoners of war just straight up executed in some of the most medieval ways you can possibly imagine, from just being shot to being bayoneted to being beheaded to being caught on fire, run over. I mean, just.
I have been
ethnic cleansing almost.
I have been very,
actually it was, yeah.
I have been very fortunate in my public school educational experiences to go on a number of field trips, mm-hmm. See a number of presentations that were poignant, stuck with me for a very long time. One of the neater ones was I got to see the Romanov jewels, the family jewels.
Ooh, yeah,
they went on, I think they still are on the global tour, or they were when I was in middle school, got to see them in person. That was neat. Very humbling experience in eighth grade. Got to go to the Holocaust Museum in D.C.
Certainly.
But when I was in, I want to say my sophomore or junior, so for our U.K. people, grade 10, grade 11, when I was in one of those two grades, not a field trip, but they broke, I don't know why, it was like one of these days where we had like two periods, went to homeroom, and then it was half the school in the morning, and then the other half of the school in the afternoon went into the auditorium and watched this like 4-hour presentation on this subject.
Oh my God.
Wow.
And
that's heavy.
I had never heard of it before. Mm-hmm. At this time in my life, World War II was literally D-Day.
Yep.
And maybe Pearl Harbor.
Maybe.
Sure.
You know, listen, man, even as a young dude, I've been able to stomach some pretty gnarly stuff. Like the Holocaust Museum was a terrible experience as far as just humanity.
Mm-hmm.
You should go. Yeah. If you're not, if you don't think you're strong enough to go, you should still go.
Definitely.
You should just still go.
Yep.
I was strong enough to handle that. Definitely carry some things, even, you know, 20 plus years later, whatever. But like this story messed me up. Mm-hmm. And now I am a parent.
Yeah.
I am now a spouse. Mm-hmm. It's so as soon as you started the sentence of where we're, I was like, I know where we're going.
Hmm.
Like I have been fortunate because, you know, it was a terrible day to learn, but it was also a good day because like I was completely unaware of it. But like my public school education exposed me to this story.
Yeah. And so it's interesting that, you know, a couple minutes ago we were saying, is this as like of an event, the initial invasion, not so much, but this, once they get to Nanjing, that's when that changes. The rest of the world reacts in absolute horror to a T. To just kind of paint you a picture, you know, the Nazi German emissary was I think in Nanjing at the time, came out and was just kind of seeing what the Japanese army was up to. Was appalled by it.
Wait, the Nazis thought it was too much?
Said it was too bad. This was too much for Nazi Germany.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, and to be fair, yes, they hadn't started the killings yet, but fascists are fascists. And for them to be like, shit.
Yeah.
Ease up there, Japan.
Yeah.
You know that's bad. So this event.
That is a dark irony.
It's, yeah, right?
I will tell you, that is a dark irony.
It really is. And it's polarizing for Japan because the rest of the world reacts and says, oh, heck no, you ain't doing this no more.
Was Japan, do you think, Avery, do you think Japan thought that it would do something like this and remain just ignored and untouched? Or, like, was it like a dare? Like, was it like a dare? Like,
I mean,
do something about it, or
I think it was more for their
like you have to know you're about to become vilified globally.
Japan is
is very different from its previous conflicts. Like during the Russo-Japanese War, they treated the Russians very well, at least POWs. Yep. And they offered proper burials. They fed their prisoners. I mean, they were all within the levels of the Geneva Convention, whatever you want to say. And by the Sino-Japanese War, the Second Sino-Japanese War, by the time they're invading China, it's just out the window. And, right. You know, you can definitely blame that on that ultra-nationalist rise in Japan, this idea that Japan, or at least the ultra-nationalist Japanese, are looking at Chinese citizens and soldiers as inferior, as something to be extinguished and to be punished. Like, they're lesser than human. They're pretty much animals. We can do what we want with them.
Right.
And I think, you know, your question is very interesting, because it's like, you know, do they think the rest of the world's even going to care that they're doing?
Like,
this?
How do you think that there's, like, at any point you're not going to be immediately viewed
thing is that American embassies are getting evacuated at this point. They're basically saying, y'all need to get out of here.
Time to get out.
And one event that's happening synonymously with the Nanjing massacre is the sinking of the USS Panay. It was a patrol ship on the Yangtze River that was strafed and sunk by Japanese Zeros, the A6M Mitsubishi Zero. This is a brand new fighter. It's sleek. It's fast. It's got cannons on it. And it's really good.
I feel like we brought this up on the Battles and Banter episode about Pearl Harbor. I think we talked about the Panay, because it's like,
the Panay is what catches our attention, especially the U.S. Navy. And they go, excuse me? Like,
what were you just doing there? Yeah. Rising sun?
Yeah. Two American sailors were killed. Son. The rest of them, everyone else on board at least escapes with injuries. But and they're not like captured by the Japanese. It's the Japanese government basically is like, it was an accident, you know, they shouldn't have been there. Blah,
oops,
blah, blah.
We didn't mean to shoot the crap out of your guys.
Yeah,
you know who's also interesting about serving on the Yangtze River? In the beginning of the 19th century, a ship that's named after a site that we're all very familiar with, the USS Monocacy.
She's
a gunboat that serves on the Yangtze.
Well, she probably was a sister ship to the Panay then, if they're serving on the same river. Were they there at the same time?
She was not there at the same time. Okay. She's there mostly during like the Boxer Rebellion.
Yeah.
And there's three of them.
That's another thing. It's like, we've been in China. America has been involved in China at this time. So it's not like we're ignorant to what's going on with China. But like, oh, Jesus Christ, Patrick.
but the point is, the eyes on
God. But like, what's interesting about this is that the Japanese ultranationalists and these propagandists back in Tokyo are basically adopting a very similar tactic to how they justify their bad behavior. So Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Germans are going to blame Franklin D. Roosevelt and his Jewish hordes for escalating unfair sanctions against them. And Japan says, yeah, you know what? That's right. You guys, it's Roosevelt's fault. It's the Jewish folks' fault.
Right.
And I'm like,
that sounds
for
right.
The, for the 12 Jews that are in the
I was going to say, I was just like, there is not a lot of Jewish folks in China. But they're saying, you know, this is, you know, the Jews, the American Jews and Roosevelt, they're labeling sanctions on us. It's not fair. And, you know, all these other Western powers, they're just doing this because there's a Jewish agenda. So it's very interesting to see Japan adopt a very similar ideology as the Nazi Germans did. And, you know, a lot of things that I want to learn more about is the comparisons between these two governments. I haven't really looked at that a lot.
Well, obviously. I'd like to know more about what you look into, because I'm sitting here wondering, did they treat Jewish POWs different?
Oh, I haven't even thought about
that. Like, you think about something as gnarly as Bataan, right? We'll come and we're going to get to that, I imagine, right?
We are.
Right?
Yep. I'm trying to keep moving here.
No, you're good. Listen, because there are things I want to get into, things I don't. If we don't get time, we'll come back. Whatever, dude. But
now we're going to be cooking with oil.
But my point. That's good. But I just, you know, it just makes me wonder sort of if the. I don't even remember what I'm talking about, but whatever.
The comparisons.
Just see if like you could find how similar the structures, I guess.
Yes.
Between the Japanese policies and the German policies.
Well, just like if you think about it, if they're adopting this sort of mentality that if they're not directly saying it's the Jewish agenda behind the English, behind the Americans, right, whatever,
I think Avery's right. I think they were just going with something that was convenient that they're
that other fascist nations are doing.
No, that's, yeah, no, like, I guess they're doing what it, I'm trying to get out of my brain is like in a situation like a Bataan, right? So they're going through all these prisoners, and if they find out one is Jewish, do they treat that person differently?
I don't know, but I'm going to say probably not, because everyone's an American, everyone's white.
Well, right. Well, that's the thing. It's like, are they parsing
Japanese?
So are they parsing much further than you're white and an American?
Bataan's going to suck for everybody.
Yeah, Bataan will equally suck no matter what name you call God. But yes, now we're cooking with oil,
Steve.
Because as a result of the USS Panay incident and the rape of Nanjing and just the general Japanese slaughtery. I know it's not a real word.
I mean, they've been aggressive.
China. They've been super uncool. And this war is not looked at as a justified conflict at all. So as a result, the United States, as well as other Western powers, start putting embargoes on the Empire of Japan.
Shutting it
down. These particularly are going to stop shipping them oil. Mm. And we're basically going to say, look, well, we know you guys need the oil to run your ships, to run your, not just naval ships, but your merchant marine, because you're an island nation.
Yeah.
And I tell you what, we'll lift that sanction, but y'all got to get out of China. And so
are they requesting a complete withdrawal from China?
A complete withdrawal from China.
Really?
Yeah.
And Manchuria as well?
Manchuria, I believe, was part of that. But I think that was actually up for debate, where they were like, let's just try to focus on getting like coastal China out of there.
Matt, we are the United States of America.
Okay.
We only do things unconditionally.
Yes.
Haven't you learned?
That's actually really funny you say that, because we're going to talk about that too. but yeah, so, you know, U.S. began imposing these sanctions as early as 1940. And then even 1941, it gets even heavier. And so, you know, they have to basically withdraw from the Asian mainland as a whole. So, yeah, that includes Manchuria. Japan, go back to Japan and stop being so bad. And we're probably going to slap your wrists about all the horrible things you were doing in China. Yeah. So Japan says, oh, man, you know what, America? You've left us no choice. We must go to war. And enter again Yu Soroku Yamamoto as the combined fleet commander. He's got one of the most powerful navies in the world under his command. But this is a guy who has told everybody, going to war with America,
bad
friggin' mistake.
Bad.
And so he, as I also said, is trying to be a good commander, you know, do his duty to the fullest. And so he is going to try to win here, regardless of whether he or not he agrees with the overall conflict or the cause, I would say. And so he was going to make a plan. He's like, look, if you want to beat the Americans in a limited time that we have, then we need to target their fleet directly, not just in where it's anchored, but also all the naval ports and their colonies. We have to hit it simultaneously, and we have to do this quickly and swiftly and aggressively and destructively. And we got to do it quickly. So I'm just repeating myself here. But Yamamoto basically is going to put Chuichi Nagumo in charge of his 6 carrier task force.
Nagumo?
Nagumo. Nagumo. N-A-G-U-M-O.
Listen, I watched Midway Nagumo last night.
Nagumo.
It's Nagumo.
Nagumo.
I'm just sure of it because
you're quoting the Midway movie that came out?
I loved it.
Oh my goodness.
Listen, all right, let's
this. I can't do it.
Can we do this at the moment we get to the actual battle? Can we save this moment for the moment of the battle in the story?
Okay. They do have a really cool name for their 6 carrier task force, which
movie
is called Kirubutai. Kirubutai is going to be the striking force that takes out the U.S. Pacific Fleet.
Oh.
And they know we have to hit them at anchor at Pearl Harbor in Oahu, Hawaii. And so they're going to be training for this as early as like 1940. They start assembling the forces to do this. So they had actually had plenty of time to prep and plan this operation. They're sending their naval aviators Kagoshima Bay. And that's a place that's going to resemble the topography and the tides of Pearl Harbor. So the pilots are actually going to be coming in and practicing delivering their torpedoes. And there's a new style of torpedo, which is the Nakajima Type 97 torpedo. And they're going to be used mainly on these. That's the Nakajima Type 97 is a bomber. That's not the torpedo itself. That's also nicknamed a Kate.
The Kate torpedo bomber.
Yes. So they have this new style of torpedo. It's got wooden fins on it. So basically when the torpedo is delivered, it's buoyant, goes right back to the surface, which means we can now do torpedo runs in shallow water. And so now they're like, okay, so what we'll do is we'll send in the Kates. They'll drop the torpedoes. We'll have our Val dive bombers. They'll drop high level bombs from high altitudes. And then the A6M Mitsubishi Zero is going to be our main fighter. And they're going to escort the torpedo bombers and the dive bombers to their targets. And so real quick, one thing I want to mention here is that this is going to be an interesting conflict because in terms of naval warfare, it's going to be a new ball game, a whole new set of tools, a whole new bowl of wax, because we're going to start to get away from dreadnought on dreadnought.
So we just like, did that 20 years
ago. Yeah. We had done that in Jutland. We did that,
at Jutland.
World War One. Yeah. And all
that was it.
Well, guess what? In the Pacific, we're going to see a transition from dreadnought on dreadnought actions, and we're going to see a rise of carrier-based action.
By the way, if you're excited for a Jutland conversation, you may want to hang around on this show in a couple of weeks. We may or may not be having a Jutland one.
Jutland.
I'm curious, Avery.
Yes.
The United States has been moving, I shouldn't say moving away, but the naval powers in the United States have been challenged by our developing Army Air Corps and the ability for...
At this time, not modern.
At this time.
Oh, at this time.
Yeah.
2024.
I'm sorry, not 2024.
That's why I was clarifying. I was like...
In the 20s, 30s, and 40s, Billy Mitchell, especially in the 20s, is doing a lot of experimentation with planes engaging ships. Mm-hmm. He's had some very public, very successful tests.
It down at the Outer Banks.
Exactly, down at the Outer Banks. It has pissed the Navy off to no means.
Yeah.
They demoted him and fired him over
it. Yes, they did. But there is real evidence that there's flaws. Yeah. There's weaknesses to dreadnoughts, to battleships from aerial attack.
Oh, yeah.
How much of that has been getting into the mindset of the Pacific Fleet?
So for our fleet, not really at all.
That's what I kind of figured.
You know, carriers are still considered kind of like, oh, this cool new thing, but it's not going to win us the war. The battleship is still the primary weapon for the U.S. Navy.
Well, that mentality plays into the Japanese approach.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Make no mistake. But like the Japanese carrier task force, Kido Butai, they're... Carriers are massive.
No, but I'm talking about like when they come into Pearl, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There's a reason that Battleship Row is hit.
Yes.
The symbolism of what Matt's talking about is like that era, right?
It was our pride.
Like, the battleships were what's up, right?
Yeah, yeah. I'm sorry. Totally misunderstood.
Yeah, you did. You're fired.
Okay. See you guys. I'm out.
Honestly,
that was the episode.
I wanted to fire you when you got the plane name wrong. You were like, actually, it's this plane. I was like, well, who booked this guy?
We can't even. The Vals, the Zeros.
There's a lot of planes. Let's be fair.
A lot of planes. If you like planes, though.
Matt, do you have a Second World War air war slideshow out there?
I do not.
Get working.
I have a favorite plane, which I've bugged Avery about many times. And
it will be mentioned.
Time out. What's his favorite plane, Avery?
P-38 Lockheed Lightning.
Damn. Woo!
What's my favorite plane, Matt?
Oh, I do know this one.
It's P-51 Mustang.
It's not the P-51.
Is it a full actually. P-47?
No. It's a naval aircraft, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
and it's
it is.
Big and fat. That's your clue.
Oh, no.
It's a fighter.
I can
see
it.
But it's so big, they could use it as a bomber.
I can see it. I can't think of the name, though.
No, it is not an F-14 Tomcat.
First of all, there are several F-14 models in this studio. You're damn right it's not. The greatest plane ever made. Love it. Maverick.
It is the F-6F Hellcat.
Hellcat.
Really?
Yes, yes.
That is my favorite World War II.
The Hellcat?
The Hellcat. Not the Dodge car.
First of all, we're not car people on this show.
not the dog.
Unless you're the person who gets passionate about the history of automobiles, and then we invite you on the show.
But so
no, Parker. Every time we're like, if you're passionate about this, Parker's hand goes up. Like, no, we can't, Parker. We need to have guests on this show.
Okay,
love you, buddy.
So, gentlemen, if you could turn to the first map under the main map. So in the maps that I brought in, I have the overall theater map. The next map is going to be Pearl Harbor itself. Now, I want to make it clear that Yamamoto is going to advocate to the Japanese government that they should declare war first and then launch a raid on Pearl Harbor. It's just going to come off better. It's going to be digested better.
All right, so you know, real quick,
yes.
How many images are in this packet?
There are 10? Nine.
Nine? Oh, there that's nine perfect, because Instagram will only allow you to post 10 pictures.
That's
so
that's right.
Here's what we're going to do interactive for you, our listeners. We are going to do a double Instagram post. We're going to have an Instagram post to promote this episode being out. And then if you literally go to the actual page, if you don't see it naturally in your timeline, in your feed, just go to the History Things podcast page. It'll be the next post right behind it. We're going to put Avery's map packet up so that you can follow along. So if you're following along, Avery has a cover sheet map, and he has asked us to open to the map just behind that. We're looking down on an image of Ford Island.
Overall Pearl Harbor,
but the biggest words that are going to stick out to you are Ford Island. So getting back into it here, just Avery will turn the mic over, but I just want our listeners to know, if you want to follow along with, this is the map Avery is using for this portion of the conversation.
Yeah, and I'm not going to spend a lot of in-depth time with each map. I'm not going to, you know, we could be here for a whole week, but I just want to give a visual just so everyone can see what I'm talking about and know the landscape at least. So this is, of course, the setup. You see Battleship Row on this map of Pearl Harbor. You got the Arizona, you got the Nevada, you got the West Virginia, Tennessee, Oklahoma, the Maryland.
Yeah, yeah. You know what I don't see there, boys? I don't see the Maine or the Michigan. That's right.
But yeah, so
shut up,
yeah. So Yamamoto is going to advocate for declaring war first before we attack Pearl Harbor, we being the Japanese. And so the Japanese government says, sure, we will send that declaration the day of the attack on December 8th, 1941. The only thing is, though,
there's an international dateline.
There's an international dateline. And, you know, that's going to complicate things a bit. So in Japan, they're like, what? It's December 8th. First day of the war with the United States.
Like, well, we didn't. Do you mean we didn't tell you on the 8th? On the 8th.
Well, it's December 7th for us over here and on the western side of things.
Yep.
And, you know, the whole Pacific Fleet is at anchor in Pearl Harbor. They had bunched all the ships together to protect them.
Smart.
Because they were worried about sabotage. There had been growing animosity. Like, no, we flip over to the United States perspective. The U.S. is well aware that things are not great with Japan, that relations are tense before Pearl Harbor. They know that, you know, the Japanese ambassadors in D.C., they're on the verge of pretty much packing up and going home. And if that happens, then it's on. So for the most part, you can imagine they are worried about any kind of Japanese sabotage of their fleet. They know their fleet is coveted, so we got to protect the fleet no matter what. So they believe that Pearl Harbor is perfect. It's shallow. Right. It's going to protect them against submarines, like any kind of
Our producer just tried to like give Matt love, by the way, behind the scenes. He just walked over and showed both Matt and I that there's a ship on this map called the Detroit.
She's a cruiser, I'm pretty sure.
Cruiser. Yes, but I don't know why I went Scottish with that.
Yeah, that was a random.
That was an interesting choice, yes.
We're clear on
this
the rules
is the moment
then.
To be from the Highlands.
Yeah, yes. I don't know.
The Detroit Highlands?
Yeah, it's, I don't know.
I mean, maybe. But anyway, the point
we
is.
We make shitty cars.
Yes, so the Pearl Harbor was selected because of its shallow bay, because of its shallow harbor. And it's going to protect against submarine attacks. It's going to be create a bottleneck at the front so that no enemy fleet can all just stream in at once. They got to basically be fed in piecemeal if they want to attack. And so they're like, this is perfect. We're safe and sound, tucked in. And there's also just a general belief that Japanese Navy can't hit us. It's Japan.
So far away.
They're so far away, and they're Japan. Literally, that is the attitude of some of the high commanders. I don't know if they could have been high.
They're probably very high.
Yeah, but some of the high command of the United States military, especially U.S. Navy, they think the ships are safe. But yes, they are worried about sabotage. They are worried about Japanese secret agents, covert agents going in and maybe destroying the rudders or planting bombs, some acts of terrorism even. So they decide the best thing to do to protect the fleet from sabotage, bunch all the ships together, get them nice and lined up in a nice, neat row, battleship row, if you will.
Yeah. Mm.
Problem with that is, man, they are real easy to hit if you send in a bunch of planes. Yeah. And so the attack's going to commence from Kido Butai. All six aircraft carriers that the Japanese send. Are we ready, gentlemen?
Oh, yes.
We're so ready.
The Zukaku, the Shukaku, the Akagi, the Kaga, the Hiru, and the Soryu, I believe is how I say it. These six carriers are going to deliver a whopping 353 planes to this attack.
My God.
Mainly two waves. First wave is supposed to hit the ships. Second waves are supposed to hit the airfields and any of the dry docks that are...
What time does this start?
This is going to start at 7:48 a.m. Hawaiian time. And the Val dive bombers, Cape torpedo planes, Zero fighters, they're going to start flying over Honolulu. They're flying towards the harbor. America... At least the civilians, and even, of course, many of the service members are so aloof to what is coming that when they first hear the planes overhead, they think, oh, I didn't know their Navy was doing exercises today. They think it's American planes. And to be fair, there was supposedly an order of B-17s coming in from California, or I think maybe Alaska, I'm not sure, somewhere from the West. And so, you know, people are like, oh, well, that's a pretty cool exercise. Even up to the point where... There is gunfire happening. They're like, oh, man, they're really getting into this exercise. And then the Arizona explodes. And that's when people are like, oh, this is not a drill. So the U.S. Pacific Fleet, it's going to be made up of 8 battleships, 8 cruisers, 30 destroyers, 4 submarines, 47 support ships, and approximately 390 aircraft stationed at Ford Island, Hickam Field, Wheeler Field, and a small airstrip at Barbers Point, mostly P-40s. I think, what are they? Wildcats, P-40 Wildcats. I love that plane, but it is a hilariously outdated fighter against the A6M0. Same thing with the planes as they did with the ships. They bent them wingtip to wingtip to make sure they couldn't be sabotaged.
Smart.
Real fun targets to shoot if you're in the air. And
looks really pretty in photos.
It does look really pretty.
Really pretty.
I'm glad it looked pretty because, man, when it's all on fire.
Jesus.
No, but
Avery's been having a rough week.
Yeah, no, yeah.
But, it's only Wednesday.
So, to get you the point here, you know, the attack is a smashing success.
Yeah.
You know, they are going to sink 4 battleships, 3 destroyers, 3 cruisers, an anti-aircraft training ship, and 1 mine layer, and everything else is destroyed. Pearl Harbor is smoking cauldron of black smoke by noon. On December 7th, all the Japanese planes have returned at the loss of only 29 aircraft and 4 midget submarines, which are these smaller, skinnier, like, I think
2-man.
They're 2-man subs.
I think they're 2-man, yeah.
One of which is grounded on the beaches of Oahu and their crews captured.
So small submarines, not.
They're not big. But not the I class.
No, they are not for little people.
Okay, not submarines.
Damn it.
Just wanted to make sure.
So, I was trying to move so quickly through that because I knew. Really
can I also just acknowledge, like, because there are some people that are new to our show that don't realize that I am, like, also a caricature of myself. Like, I did know that that was not what that was, but I am such a child that I could not resist the ability. Like, I'm sitting behind a microphone and I am immature. I had to say something. Of course,
I love you, Pat.
I know that's not for the wee folk.
Real quick, Avery.
Yes, Matt. Yes, Matt.
No. That one's all right, right? We can say that. Like,
when it comes,
we'll find out if we can't say it.
Yeah, oh no joke,
Matt. Question, please.
When it comes to the attack on Pearl, you had made a really good point earlier about striking at the military ability of the Pacific Fleet.
Yes,
and you'd mentioned that Yamamoto wants to destroy the support network as well.
Yeah.
I have heard, and please tell me if I'm mistaken here, that there is such a drive, and understandably so, because they're great big fat targets.
Yes.
But there's this warrior mentality within the Japanese aviators that they are gunning for the battleships and the other vessels, but they're not hitting, like, the tank farms. And that means so fuel tanks, folks.
That's the fuel. That's the oil refineries and everything, which initially was going to be the target of a third wave, which is held off by Isoroku Yamamoto.
You mean Shermans don't just grow from the ground?
I wish. That'd be awesome. That
it was like the awesome. Greatest clarification. And I mean,
you know what?
Fuel tanks, just, not it's, armament. It's
just,
damn it.
It's just like,
it needs to
it's
be
just
said.
Like Saruman and the Uruk-hai. You know, you go down, you dig up, you know, and there's just this muddy womb, but inside it's a metal tank. And
I'm never opposed to it, but like, why? What a moment to go to Middle Earth on our show right
You're
there.
Welcome.
Like, right there.
Just imagine M4 Sherman's being dug out of the ground. Anyway.
All right.
But yeah, no. So.
Roosevelt.
Yeah, I missed next to Fury on the barrel. I missed the white hand of Saruman.
Dude,
painted right on the barrel.
Dollar. If there were any Lord of the Rings fans in World War II and they were that
oh,
nerdy,
they would have been.
They would have slapped their hands in powder on the sides of the Shermans. I can only hope. But the point is that third wave was supposed to hit these oil refineries, and it is withheld. Yamamoto holds it back. He says, we've done it. We've had two waves. And there's, like, I think a little bit of a hesitation by him to commit any more forces, because
right.
if the carrier fleet hangs around, because you know there's something he's being told by intelligence is that U.S. carriers are not there. So where are the U.S. carriers? Well, they're on their way. They're already on their way back. You had the USS Enterprise,
Woo!
USS Hornet, and I believe USS Saratoga. Don't check me on that, but these three carriers were coming back in from Central America. I think they had made.
Oh,
port
were they?
In.
I thought they were.
They
up
may
there.
Have been in San Diego too. I'm not sure. I'm failing already. But point is that they're not at
no
Pearl Harbor.
About it. Yeah,
they're
not there.
At Pearl Harbor. And so because of that, there is that lingering threat that Yamamoto's like, listen, we can't stick around because we could get slapped too. You just don't know. Don't know enough. So they're going to start to pull back that second wave. They hit the airfields. They hit. Obviously Battleship Row and most of the harbor, but they don't hit is a lot of the dry docks either. And so that's a critical disadvantage or a critical
mistake.
Yeah, because now they can now we, the Americans, can fix everything you're
and
breaking.
That's a great right. point. So all ships except the USS Arizona are going to be raised. And a few of them actually return to duty. Even the USS Oklahoma, which capsized and sank mast first into
right.
the bottom of Pearl Harbor, is going to be raised and righted by, I believe, summer of 43.
Does it go back into, like, active service?
I don't think it goes into active service, but they at least get it right side up and drained
get it,
of water.
Get its people home
and
buried.
Get the bodies out. Yeah, yeah, which at that point, mm-hmm. those bodies are very waterlogged.
Yeah, but I just meant more like at that point, just trying to say, like, they got people
yeah,
home.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know
that's,
what I'm saying?
That's what's crazy.
Absolutely.
So a lot of these smoking wrecks, you know, specifically the California, the Tennessee, the West Virginia, they're going to be raised. The Pennsylvania is going to be raised. Maryland's going to be raised. They're all going to go on to fight, and we're going to mention them later. But the damage is done. You know, it's pretty bad. You had 188 aircraft destroyed and another 159 aircraft damaged. As I already said, four battleships, three destroyers, three cruisers, an anti-aircraft training ship, and a mine layer. They're sunk. Everything else is heavily damaged. As terms of casualties, U.S. casualties include 2,008 sailors, 109 Marines, 208 soldiers, and 68 civilians killed for a grand total of 2,403 American lives. Mm. So that's a steep number. I always thought it was 2,400 casualties. No, that's killed. That's
You're right.
outright killed, yeah. most of which obviously is the naval forces. The entire crew of the Arizona almost goes down with the ship.
Right.
Because, real quick, got to mention the Arizona, and that's the one thing I will say Michael Bay got right in the movie, is the high-level Val bombers are going to drop. Actually, it wasn't a Val. It wasn't a dive bomber. It was just a regular bomber, and I don't know what they're called. But it dropped a high-level bomb, hit the front of the ship, penetrated the deck, went down into the magazine of one of the turrets, one of the main turrets, and then it exploded. And according to the accounts from that day, they said it looked as if the ship, the USS Arizona, buckled and then belched and left the water when it blew. It was that big of an explosion. That explosion kills pretty much, I think, 600 to 1,000 men, like, outright. And then everyone else drowns. I mean, it's a brutal, brutal hit. And so the Arizona is the only ship from Pearl Harbor from that day that still resides on the bottom of the harbor. And you can visit it today. I know I want to.
You can visit where the war in the Pacific began for the Americans and technically where it ended right next door to each other.
Hiroshima is really kicking off. Actually, currently is kicking off a huge tourism campaign.
Yeah.
Right now. Like, it's like I've seen it on YouTube. Like, yeah, people are now being sponsored by Hiroshima Tourism. So
that's crazy.
Really crazy.
But I just meant more the Mighty Mo, the Missouri. Yeah, the Mighty Mo is at anchor, almost right next door to the Arizona now. Yep. And so now you can go to see where...
You don't have to go all the way to Japan.
Yeah, you don't have to go to Tokyo Bay to do... And honestly, for those like us who are on the East Coast of the United States, we can go visit part of this story in just a few hours by driving to Morgantown, West Virginia.
Yep.
The Kahn Tower from the USS West Virginia, proudly on display, I believe, on the center of that campus.
Her anchor's there, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe so.
I know the Kahn Tower is also there because they're. I don't know what I watched, but I remember I woke up in the middle of some nap and I was like, whoa. Like Keanu Reeves. Yeah. But as like a Syracuse sports fan in the old Big East, I don't have a lot of love for the Mountaineer, you know, college there because West Virginia used to be a conference rival. And so normally I'm like poo, but since we're not anymore, I allowed myself to be entertained by that. But yeah, I learned that you can visit the Kahn Tower there. Yeah. My buddy Rob that I work with is a loyal West Virginian, and he is going to be pumped that I'm bringing that up, and also be like, "Oh, Pat, you spoke so poorly about that. I just let West Virginia down as a state entirely."
Indeed, you did. And on that note,
that's blame Canada.
blame Canada.
Canada.
Oh, okay. But yeah, there was another 1,178 military personnel and civilians that were wounded. So civilians, real quick, there were accounts of Japanese planes strafing downtown Honolulu. It's not as graphic or as like glorified, or that's not the right word I would use. Just not as Hollywoodized.
Can I ask this question?
As Michael Bay made it seem.
Did it happen?
It happened.
Like in a simple yes or no, did it happen on any level?
It happened on a level, on a small level.
But like,
there's also accounts of U.S. ships trying to return fire on these planes and it's overshooting into the city. So.
I totally believe that.
Well, so what I was going to ask, it was sort of a multi-parted question to get to that point, is was it 100% a Japanese zero strafing? Was it errant return fire coming
let's
down?
Let's just put it this way, Pat. It was chaos.
People in Honolulu, though, were
getting caught up
experiencing the battle. Like
at least the parts of the city closest to the harbor.
Sure, sure.
So they're definitely getting caught up in it. Plus, there are civilian workers at the facilities. You know, you had janitors, you had...
Well, when you think of the killed and wounded combined casualty total, we, up until September 11th, 2001, talked about this as our worst single-day national tragedy, right?
Yep. And yeah, so that, oh, absolutely.
That's why there's, you know, if you live long enough, you're going to see the horrors repeat. That's why there were old folks, you know, our old timers, right? All of us, right? Yep. You know, we're becoming middle-aged ourselves. Well, maybe not Avery. Avery's still like 16. But all the rest of us who are starting to get gray hair and things like that, creeping ever closer to AARP memberships. You know, we have been around now to see a bunch of things kind of, you know, when we were younger, they were tragic. We've seen some newer ones. But think about that. You live long enough, there was people that saw Pearl Harbor and 9/11, things like that. Yep. So when I think about, and just to be clear, just to reiterate again, we're staying at about 30,000 feet. If you're like looking for the Pearl Harbor episode, we haven't done it yet. We'll get there. We'll get into the story in a much greater detail. Go listen to Matt and I on Avery's Battle and Banter podcast. It is available wherever podcasts are found right now.
Only
so
on Spotify right now. iTunes is no longer.
Oh,
hosting.
Yeah?
Yeah, they kicked us.
Why?
Because I stopped paying for
that makes sense. Anyway. All right, well, go to Spotify and pull up the Battles and Banter archive there. And Matt and I did an episode with Avery where we got into this, but we'll do some more detailed focus looks, because what I want to do, and not on this show, is I want to rip the movie a little bit.
Yeah.
I want to talk about some things the movie gets right, because I think that. It is a valid part of the conversation now, is the pop culture, you know, engagement with this Pulp Fiction. But like, you know, like my wife, for instance, right? God bless my wife. On December 7th this past year, texted me first thing in the morning and said, "It's the anniversary of one of the greatest love stories ever told." Jeez. And I was like, I was proud of my wife because she was aware that it was Pearl Harbor Day. And I was also very, which, and this is why I want to rip it on another episode, because it's one of the worst love stories. Like, dudes are not loyal to each other. It's a terrible love story, but like, you know, most people became aware of that story through things like that film or whatever. So when we do more focused looks,
get people in the theater somehow.
So we'll get into Pearl Harbor another day. We'll get into Michael Bay and the whole movie.
All right. So the same day,
Cuba Gooding
the
Jr.
Same, yeah, great part by the way.
December 7th.
Yes, yeah, the same day that Pearl Harbor is attacked, December 8th on the demarcation line. You have Japanese naval assets attacking Western naval and army installations across the Pacific. You also had fighting at the Philippines, Guam, Wake Island, Singapore, Burma, which is today Myanmar, and Indochina, which is today Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, the Dutch East Indies. Literally, in an incredible feat, you have the Japanese Navy and Army moving simultaneously and hitting these targets at the same time.
Even though they don't like each other, they're working in coordination with each other.
Well, now we have a common goal, common enemy.
Or the Americans are here.
The allies. Yeah. You target the allies. Let's take them out.
Are they thinking about the allies, or are they thinking about the Americans? Like, how much of a presence does, England have?
We are the biggest threat in the Pacific because we had the biggest fleet.
Like, the Canadians, I'm sure, have to be there. Yeah, they have a Pacific presence. I mean, they share a coastline. Funny,
that's a great segue. Real quick, I'm going to mention there are two ships off Singapore that are sunk. They are British warships, the HMS Prince of Wales and the HMS Repose, I believe.
I say.
Yes, and they... So this was, it's interesting about these two ships being sunk. Excuse me. They're British dreadnoughts or British battleships that are at sea, not at anchor, fully combat operational, and they're still taken out by Japanese air power. So I think this case was more of a test of, we can actually do this. We can hit, enemy battleships in open water at their fullest capabilities and still sink them. And, it was showing a lot I'm having a brain fart. At least the downsides of not updating your militaries and being prepared. This lack of preparedness on the side of the Allies for a global war. Obviously, Japan's been at war since 1932, so they are ready to go, and they have had plenty of time to prepare adequately. We, on the other hand, the Americans, the Allies, we are just so fully unprepared for what is coming at us in December of 1941.
Yeah, our interwar periods were not very focused on what was definitely
we had limited our fleet. Not to mention, we'd cannibalized a little bit of the Pacific fleet and sent them to the Atlantic to help out Britain. And Britain, to their credit, has Germany to worry about at this time. They've already been defending their home islands by air. And, everything we're sending over there is getting picked off by German U-boats. And so now their assets in the Pacific are getting demolished by the Japanese. And Hitler was like, yeah, he's
that
happy
dude,
about this.
Best German impression I've ever heard in my life.
Oh, you're very welcome. Yeah.
And then a few years, he's like, Scheiße.
Yeah, pretty much.
Very
soon.
Different. Very different.
999 very soon.
Very different.
But yeah, no, what he's a bastard. Happy. He's basically like, Japan, you're doing me a solid. Yeah, destroy their interests out there, and you'll take some pressure off of us. So, there was a lot of, the Axis powers being at their height during this time.
Germany's like looking at their selves, and they're like, yo, they did what Mexico did not do 20 years ago. Like, do you believe that? Like, do you see what just happened? Like, Japan did it.
A nice reference to the Zimmerman telegram.
But if you think about it, right, like in the previous war, Germany is actively soliciting Mexico to do something similar, like engage these people to keep them not engaged with us. Mm-hmm. So
it's on a much larger scale.
So Hitler's like, I want to say he's probably like, thanks, but I don't ever want to speak kindly or humorously about him. Adolf Hitler's like one of the most horrible people in the entirety of existence of humanity. So I just want to be very clear.
He's a military strategist, though.
I just want to be very clear. Any humor or levity that comes out of this episode, especially in dark times, at all times on our show, Adolf Hitler. Just want to say that very clearly.
But yes, so one thing that does come out of these dark days of December of 1941. Is just the general, now it's on attitude in the United States. Mm-hmm. You have recruiting depots just filling up with young men and women looking to serve their country and get into this war. Now, it should be noted, a lot of them are going to be heading to Europe when they wanted to go to the Pacific, because that's not the issue they have. They're not mad at Nazi Germany. They're mad at Empire Japan.
Right.
They hit us at anchor unexpectedly, by surprise. They didn't even declare war.
Explain that a little bit, Avery, yeah, with the Europe first idea.
So this idea of Europe first is going to come mainly from the British. Winston Churchill is like, listen, I know that you, America,
took FDR, a hit.
You took a hit, but I'm going to need you to come across the pond and help us out because we need your help. And I mean, it's fair. I mean, by this point, the Soviets have been invaded. They're getting schwacked.
America, I will need your help.
Yes, and Britain stands alone.
It has been proved that pestilences may break out in the old world, which carry their destructive ravages into the new world, from which, once they are afoot, the new world can not escape. Duty and prudence alike command. First, that the germ centers of hatred and revenge should be constantly and vigilantly served and treated in good time, and that an adequate organization should be set up to make sure that the pestilence can be controlled at its earliest beginnings before it spreads and rages throughout the entire earth. Five or six years ago, it would have been easy, without shedding a drop of blood, for the United States and Great Britain to have insisted on the fulfillment of the disarmament clauses of the treaties which Germany signed after the Great War. And that also would have been the opportunity for assuring to the Germans those materials, those raw materials, which we declared in the Atlantic Charter should not be denied to any nation, victor or vanquished. The chance has passed. It is gone. Prodigious hammer strokes have been needed to bring us together today. If you will allow me to use other language, I will say that he must indeed have a blind soul who cannot see that some great purpose and design is being worked out here below, of which we have the honor to be the faithful servants. It is not given to us to peer into the mysteries of the future. Still I avow my hope and faith, sure and inviolate, that in the days to come, the British and American peoples will, for their own safety and for the good of all, walk together in majesty, in justice, and in peace.
So, I mean, there was this idea that if Britain falls, we're even more up the creek. So we have to save Britain and the home islands. We got to send our air power, our tanks, most of our naval assets, our ground forces. They got to go to Europe. Well, the problem with that is Japan is moving quickly, and they're covering a lot of ground. So literally, there's a conundrum that we are facing, and it's like, listen, I get it makes sense to have a Europe first strategy, but we literally got to stop the Japanese at some point, and we can't stop them if we don't have the men or material to do so.
Like our logistics have to be in place. By the way, whenever we talk about the English, I always imagine the United States, like John Cusack standing outside of the window in the rain and holding up the boombox, and it's just like, I can't quit you, girl. Because, like, you think about it, it's like, we're always like, we need to rush to defend England. It's like, remember once upon a time, we were, like, very actively not trying to engage and be English?
This is all about strategy, sir. This is strategy.
At some point, we'll do this big, are we British or are we not, conversation and lesson. And then look at the special relationship. But, like, I'm just listening to this, and it's like, Churchill's like, please. And we're like, you know what? Yeah, we can't quit you.
England, we can't quit you. We're coming to get you.
We got you, babe.
Man, and here's the thing, though. To Yamamoto's credit, we needed time to get organized. We needed time to basically wake up our factories, wake up all of our installations. You know, we have to get our men trained up. You got to get them ready. And here's the thing. The guys who are first signing up, like, for example, men who are going to be fighting in the 1st Marine Division on soon to come, we're going to be talking about that in a moment, they are given like 6 weeks of training and then they're sent to the Pacific because they're like, listen, we got to go. Yeah. We got to get moving. And also, we have standing forces currently engaged. Our largest contingent is on the Philippines. And by December 10th, Japanese ground forces have landed in the Philippines. And
you know, they are in active combat and we're getting schwacked pretty hard at this point. But at the same time, young men and young American men and women are enlisting, they are, you know, they're seeing the industry is waking up and we realize, okay, so we have to create the strategy. We have to stop Japan where they're at. We'll make more of a defensive posturing for them and protect our assets that are still here while we're also going to start sending stuff to Europe. But that was a constant issue throughout the Second World War. And I think people don't realize that is that when you look at the campaigns, if you look at the Pacific and Europe at the same time, all the major campaigns between 42 and 43 are it's a seesaw. They're not happening at the same time. It's because, okay, we're doing stuff over in Africa, and now we're doing stuff back in the Pacific. You know, we're doing stuff in Italy, and now we're doing stuff back in the Pacific. And it's not until the summer of 44 that you have parallel campaigns happening at the same time. Biggins, too.
So it's summer, so it's like, when you mean like right when we land in France, or is it like once we're
like
established
by June
in France?
44, there are major campaigns happening in the Pacific, as well as obviously Normandy.
Okay.
Well, but yeah, the guy that's going to be selected to win us a victory for the Americans in the Pacific is a guy by the name of Chester Nimitz.
Yes.
And it should be noted that Nimitz had already been offered the job as the commander-in-chief of the Pacific, that's CINCPAC. And he had been offered that job back in the summer of 1941, but he said, I don't have the credentials. I'm not experienced. I can't do that job. But he had impressed a lot of superior naval officers, including Ernest J. King, who's the Secretary of the Navy. And so King and Roosevelt meet, and they basically decide, no, Nimitz is our guy. We need to send him out there. The poor CINCPAC that was in charge during the Pacific, guy by the name of Husband Kimmel. His first name's Husband.
That's so weird.
Right? Cool.
Really weird.
Husband. He's going to definitely go down for losing the Pacific Fleet. So he's already a scapegoat. His interim CINCPAC commander, the commander-in-chief of the Pacific, is going to be the guy by the name of William Pye, P-Y-E.
They try to make Husband Kimball such a, what's the word? Like, you feel bad for him in Midway.
Scapegoat.
Yeah, well, no, in Midway, they try to make you feel bad because he has that like, make sure they listen to you. Like, it's like, oh.
And to his credit, he had been trying to, like, you know, wake people up. But, you know, he was aware there was a threat, just didn't know when or where it was coming from. But as this is all happening, Nimitz has got to take his time getting out there. So, like, by end of December, Nimitz will be, you know, out at Pearl Harbor. But during this whole time period, during the month of December, there is a very dramatic story going on. And that, of course, is the Siege of Wake Island. There is a very small naval and marine garrison on this island, about, I don't know the exact numbers. I want to say like 500 to like 600 guys total. But on December 8th, you got 34 Japanese G3M bombers starting to hit the airfield at Wake Island. And there is only one squadron of F4F Wildcats, which is going to be the precursor to the F6F Hellcat. It is, like the P-40, wildly inadequate compared to the Japanese air power at this point, but it's going to hold its own for as long as it can. So you got to give it that. Also, we're sitting on the tarmac wingtip to wingtip. So,
of course,
tip to tip.
But God, here's what I think is really interesting for us being Civil War guys. The Wake senior officer, Commander Winfield Scott Cunningham.
Hey-o.
Another
Winfield Scott is going to prepare to defend the Attle for as long as possible because he realizes chances of the Navy rescuing us is pretty slim.
Can we get some new names in the military, please?
No, Winfield Scott's a great name.
All right, well, here you go. So from the beach defenses, the Marine garrison under Major James Devereaux is going to spot the silhouette of the Japanese invasion force on the morning of December 11th, coming up from the Kwajalein and Roy Namur Islands and the Marshall Islands. The battle's going to start off at 5 a.m. Japanese naval bombardment begins. Cunningham and Devereaux, they're going to order their batteries to return fire with their 5-inch naval guns. These are big guns. They're going to return fire at 6:15. And their targeting equipment for these batteries had been destroyed by all the bombs and the naval bombardments. So the gunners are going to find range by the time-honored technique of firing and spotting the splashes made by falling shells.
Old school.
Yep. Guns of Battery L on Wilkes Island of Wake Atoll is actually going to sink the Japanese destroyer Hayate after hitting its powder magazine. Yo. So they see it go up, and I'm like, yeah! I'm sorry, that's awesome. Like, a coastal gun is like,
the spotter's like, that's a hit.
That's a hit. That's a,
that's a good one.
Also, four Wildcats are going to get up in the air. They're going to strafe the destroyer Kisaragi and ignite its depth charges in her bow.
Oof.
So she's going to get blown clear out of the water, and she's going to sink. So two ships at Wake Island are sunk.
Let's go.
And they did a movie about Wake Island, too, way back in the day.
I can't remember it. I don't know if I ever saw it, but...
Was it called Wake Island?
It was.
Wake. And the gun crews and the aviators, you know, they had damaged 9 of the 13 ships in the Japanese invasion force. They sank 2 of them. So Japanese losses are approximately 500 casualties, while the U.S. sustained only 1 dead and 4 wounded. That is between December 8th and 11th. So they're actually going to hold out for as long as they can. But they are going to be down to 2 Wildcats by the end of that first action. And so on December 17th, Vice Admiral Pai, who is, of course, the interim commander between Kimmel and Nimitz, he is going to be charged with the relief of Wake, and he is not confident in its resupply efforts. He also knows the only way to get reinforcements and supply out there is by sending our carriers, which are our only major ships we have left. Nobody wants to put the carriers in jeopardy unnecessarily. So he's very hesitant to do so. And after a larger Japanese landing force is going to return to Wake on December 20th, Pai hears about this and it says, it's not worth risking the carrier. I can't send the carrier. He had been sending one of them out there, the USS Saratoga. He's going to order them back on the 20th. So Wake is officially going to surrender. I want to say it's the 23rd, December 23rd. So a day before Christmas Eve, I believe.
Boo.
It's a bad Christmas in 41. But, you know, that's the first major, like, we clap back a little bit. Obviously, we still lose, but we go down swinging. And
for that propaganda, they put that film out I mentioned in 42.
Yep.
August that's of why. 42.
That's it.
Okay.
Yep. So, yeah, it's at the same time, we're still getting hammered pretty hard in the Philippines. We've lost Guam at this point. You know, the British are basically getting run out of Singapore at the same time. The Japanese are going to start preparing to land on various islands because the Navy's just been running wild through the Dutch East Indies, through the South Pacific. Australia is freaking out. New Zealand's freaking out because they know they're probably going to be next. And so it's not great. And morale is at an all-time low, especially for the American forces. So
understandable.
New year, 1942. And I would call this, if I had to write a book about 1942, I'd just call it the sweaty year.
Oh,
because it's a sweaty year for the U.S. Navy.
Oh my God.
It is for the U.S. Navy. It is probably their costliest year of the war. And it's just a lot is on the line here. There's a lot of Hail Marys being thrown in this year. And it is just gnarly. But it gets kicked off with our first official strike back. And I titled this on my notes, America Strikes Back.
Oh, yeah.
because
we are the empire.
So as I just said, yeah. So as I said, the Japanese force that took Wake came from the Marshall Islands, which is directly south. Gentlemen, if you look back at the first map that we have here, you can get a sense of where we're at.
All right, Instagram, go back to your cover sheet.
So go back to that cover sheet. You see there is Wake Island up there in the middle of the ocean, a little speck. Those guys felt super isolated. Directly south of that is Marshall Islands. The Japanese garrison is going to be located there on Kwajalein as well as the islands of Roy and Namur. So the U.S. Navy decides to build a task force called Task Force 8. Chester Nimitz, that's his first order of business. And he is going to put a new kind of commander he's been in the Navy for a while, but he's going to be a rising star. And that is a guy by the name of Admiral William Halsey. Yes, for our Navy Bull. Historians, y'all know Bull Halsey, which is funny because he hated that nickname.
Did he really?
Yeah, such a baller nickname. He did not
like that nickname. He's like, only people who don't know me call me Bull. And I'm like, huh, interesting. I would have totally owned that nickname.
That's a cool one.
No, right? Call me Bull.
And he says cool things like haul ass with Halsey.
Yeah, haul ass with Halsey.
So anybody got any ointment for this damn rash?
Yes. We're going to talk about that as well.
We're going to talk about the rash tonight?
We're going to talk about the rash, yeah. Because, I mean, we can't talk about Midway without talking about the rash. Anyway, he's going to build Task Force 8 around the USS Enterprise. This is the pluckiest, luckiest U.S. aircraft carrier in the whole war.
Damn straight.
It is awesome. It's probably one of my favorite ships. They're going to target Kwajalein Atoll. And this raid is going to kick off with Halsey in command. This is also the first time that another admiral by the name of Raymond Spruance is going to make an appearance for the first time. He's going to be benched for this, but he is present for Task Force 8's mission. And we're going to remember that name.
Wait, he's like benched or he's just not called
off
the bench?
He's not in command. He's not.
Okay, because like
Halsey's running the show.
Because like, dude, I used to play sports. Like when you say bench, to me that sounds
he's
like
the reserve bench.
Okay, great. Because when I hear bench, it means like you're coming out of the game. Like I'm benching you.
No, but that's interesting you say that because I'm getting
like husband Kimmel just got benched.
Husband Kimmel's got he's off the team.
But that's my
Kimmel's
point.
Off the team. His career
he got released. They cut his contract. There was a red tag in his locker. They said you're
working for the Canadian. You're
out of here. What's the third largest navy in the world at that time? Don't diss the Canadians on this show.
I just did it because it gets a rise out of Pat. I love you.
I just love Canada.
I know. Anyway, American Air Power, they're going to go into this raid, and it's mostly made up of these F-4F Wildcat Interceptor fighters, which, as I said, are not superior to the Zero at all. But luckily for them, there's hardly any Zero stationed in the Marshall Islands. It's mostly the Kates and the Vals. And the Nates, which are the Type 97 fighters. The Nates are a slower, sluggisher version of the Zero.
And they can tangle with these.
They can. Wildcats can tangle with the Nates.
Nice.
The raid was the first U.S. tactical quote-unquote success in the Pacific War, with about a 6,500-ton transport and sub-chaser being sunk. So it's also known these aren't just Japanese airfields, they're naval ports as well. So they're trying to sink as many ships as they can, trying to destroy as many planes as they can, and, you know, make a dent. So they're going to sink these two ships and damage about 9 others. About 90 Japanese service members will be killed, including the Marshall Islands garrison commander, Rear Admiral Yukichi Yashiro. And nearly 18 Japanese planes were destroyed as well. But overall, raid's doing very little damage to the Japanese installation there.
Big fish for a raid.
Yeah, but for a raid for the first official slap back, it's like, yeah, we can still fight. And we can still hit you where you think you're safe.
Right.
So, but that's going to be extended even further. Because while this is happening, and it is, you know, it does try to raise morale, but unfortunately, the Marshall Islands raid is going to be overshadowed by a lot of Japanese successes on land and off on the water. As of January 1942, the Japanese Navy and Army, they're going to establish new beachheads at the following locations throughout the Dutch East Indies. They're going to go to Brunei on January 6th, Jesselton on January 11th, Eastern Borneo on the Manado Peninsula, also on the 11th. They're also going to go to Tarakan Island, Balikpapan on January 24th, Kendari on Celebes, on January 24th as well, and Amboina on January 31st, which is going to open the way to the north coast of Australia, where Darwin is. But Japanese High Command wanted to secure Port Moresby on the southern tip of Papua New Guinea before planning a possible land invasion of the Australian continent. So if you look at your maps,
they are so darn close.
It's you look. That's the furthest advanced south. Like, literally, there was nothing between Japanese-occupied territory and mainland Australia to the west. So where Darwin is on the map, you can see they were definitely getting bombed by Japanese air power.
Have you ever met an Australian?
Yes.
Yeah. I would never have wanted to have invaded that continent. Kidding me? Have you seen the things that Australians just live with in their daily lives? Like,
it's nightmare fuel. They have spiders as big as your face.
And crocodiles that eat sharks
that eat crocodiles.
And they're normal. Like, they're just like, oh, yeah.
Oh yeah, you know, mate.
They're like, "Oh, right, mate. Look at that. That's a that's called a
salty
a human crab. What that thing does is it eats literal humans, mate. It's all right, and you know, it's just all right, mate. Suddenly I became British, but like at the end of the day, when I think about it, I'm really good at accents. But when I'm not, I'm not. But my point getting back on this
I've
is like
I've been an interpreter for a long time. Do not confuse the two. Either one will fight.
I know. But like, I would never want to evade that. Yeah. Like, Australians are just fighters.
Yeah.
What was Parker's going to love this reference. South Park does the Russell Crowe fighting around the world. Right. And people forget he's Australian. Yeah, but like, he's just fighting around the world. Yeah. So
I wouldn't go to war with Australia.
I wouldn't go. Yeah, would not invade that
But
continent.
Nevertheless, Japan is right up on there.
That's why they stopped.
Yeah. And at the same time that's happening, you know, there is the fall of the Philippines. It's a pretty big blow. So backtracking a little bit. The guy in command at the Philippines is General Douglas MacArthur. He has a very complicated position within the U.S. Army because the dude is basically Admiral, like General Supreme, basically, in the Pacific.
He thought he was, too.
He thought he was, too. The guy is super loving the smell of his
Him and Hirohito were like divine, right?
Yeah.
You too?
And here's the thing. Douglas MacArthur is going to dismiss early warnings of any kind of Japanese invasion threat. And he's going to eat crow on December 10th. Because that's when Japanese troops begin landing on Luzon, which is the largest and northernmost island in the Philippines. He will adopt, as a result, War Plan Orange, which meant that the Philippine capital of Manila would have to be abandoned, and his forces sent south to dig in on the Bataan Peninsula and the island of Corregidor.
Uh-oh.
Philippine President Manuel Quezon evacuates with MacArthur and his staff, but understandably is salty about it because he's got to leave his homeland behind. But that's when Japanese army troops begin entering Manila on January 2nd, 1942. And only Philippine resistance elements, like guerrillas, being their only obstruction. By the time that MacArthur is going to leave the Philippines, he mysteriously, and this is something that's crazy I want us to think about, he will receive payment from the Philippine Treasury for approximately $500,000 on January 3rd, 1942.
For what?
Mystery. And here's the even crazier thing. Both President Roosevelt and Secretary of War Henry Stimson both knew about this transaction and had never raised any questions about it.
That's weird, man.
That's super weird.
Dude, did MacArthur kill somebody?
No, he was basically acting outside, like, United States.
All right, like I will give
basically,
you.
Was the Philippines paying him to, like, try to do everything he can to defend him?
They
or what?
Loved him. It's very strange. Now, to be fair, the guy had tried to quell a lot of the Philippine resistance against the United States.
That's what, I mean, maybe that's and what so, Matt's asking. Like, is that payment for, like, using the U.S. military to do that?
Honestly, man, I don't know enough about it. Ian W. Toll mentioned it in Pacific Crucible and didn't really expand on it. And so I was kind of like, well, hold up. Wait a minute. That's super interesting. Like, what's going on there? So, yeah, it's very strange. It's very, very strange. And
so
MacArthur is
gone.
He's out of the Philippines by March. He's got big $500,000 in his pocket, which even in 1942 is a lot of money.
Yeah.
And he's going to leave his troops to fend for themselves.
What a bastard.
With pretty much no air or naval air support. And General Jonathan Wainwright will succeed MacArthur as commander of the doomed troops. Wainwright will make a reappearance on the USS Missouri at 1945 at the surrender.
Let's go.
So good for you, Wainwright. By April 9th, 1942, there will be 78,000 Americans trapped on the Bataan Peninsula by a much larger Japanese force, and they will surrender. One of the largest surrenders in U.S. military history, I think, puts Harper's Ferry in 1862 to shame.
Well, let's do that, because we have mentioned this moment on our show multiple times, because especially in Maryland campaign season, we always talk about when the Harper's Ferry garrison surrenders. It's like 12 to 14,000, right? And that's the largest surrender of U.S. troops until 1942. Up until 1942 for this moment. So here we are at the moment we are always using as a comparison to our Harper's Ferry moment. Right. So,
and to be fair, this is a conglomerated force of American and Philippine forces. So not all of those 78,000, but majority.
I think
of them
it's like 40,000 at least are American.
Yeah, 40,000 like, American. And then I think,
like 20 to 30,000, something like that. Yeah.
20 to 38,000.
But either way, it's not 14,000. I mean, 14,000 in 1862 in Harper's Ferry, Virginia at the time.
Yeah, and it was only 12,700 something, actually. But,
I knew Matt was going to come with the official number because, like, you can't speak generally about the Maryland campaign around Matt. He's like, I've been training you for too long. Be precise, damn it.
Yes.
But this is the moment. So 40-ish thousand Americans, 78-ish thousand total in this force with the Philippines. I mean, this is a devastating failure.
Yes.
It's a small army,
And they had held out for 3 months to their credit without air support or naval support. But they were starving, they were malnourished, they had diseases, and they were getting bombed and shelled every day. So,
and this is the march, right?
This is leading to the march.
So they haven't even gone on the march
yet. So they have to get off the peninsula. They're being marched two POW camps in the northern parts of Luzon. Biggest one will be Cabanatuan Prison of War Camp is going to be one of the most notoriously brutal Japanese POW camps for Americans and any other allied people they capture. There will be atrocities committed in this camp. There will be beheadings. There will be tortures. There will be experimentation. And even before they get there, though, they're going to be marched there. And it will be called the Bataan Death March. They have, I don't know the mileage, but it's frickin' far. All on foot in their malnourished state. Of those 78,000 troops that surrendered, 10,000 of them will perish on this march. Wow. Either because of just dying of their wounds or their diseases or ailments, or just being killed, shot because the Japanese troops are bored. And plus, like the loser is shamed. There's no honor in the defeat anymore. And so, And I'll end this just by saying this is a poem that was made by Frank Hewlett, who was an American journalist who gets
65 miles.
Yeah, 65 miles, oof. Which and if you try walking 65 miles with malaria or yellow fever, or God knows what else.
Or walking 65 miles. Or just 65 miles, period.
Yeah, at gunpoint, it sucks. but Frank Hewlett, American journalist, also captured at Bataan. He will create a poem beforehand, and I love it. It says, "We're the battling bastards of Bataan. No mama, no papa, no Uncle Sam, no aunts, no uncles, no cousins, no nieces, no pills, no planes, or artillery pieces, and nobody gives a damn." So this is a brutal, abysmal defeat. And once again, morale is tanked for especially the Americans. So we need to get morale back. We need to do something bold. We need to show the Japanese that they are not invincible, that they're not super soldiers like everyone thinks they are. So they come up with this crazy plan to launch B-25 Mitchell medium bombers from a carrier to strike not any little island in the Pacific, strike the Japanese home islands.
Let's do it.
So what the Japanese had initially wanted, oh, it's coming. They don't know about it. So this mission will be led by Lieutenant Colonel James Doolittle, not Dr. Doolittle. Who at the time was one of the best acrobatic pilots in the country. He had done crazy stunts. He'd done barrel rolls and, you know, maneuvers of all kinds and stuff. And he's a crazy dude.
Younger guy, he's right? Like too dude. Young for Great
yeah.
War?
Yeah.
Oh, the reason I'm asking is not only did we do the episode on this show about the Great War in the air,
yeah.
but in terms of this timeline, we're only like 20 plus years
yeah.
from the First World War sticks yeah. and paper yeah. Oh, yeah. era. So like, you know, pilots are not just like generational things yet at this point. No. So to being a pilot's kind of rare. That's why the fact that one of my grandfathers was a naval aviator is like so baller to me. It's like cool. But going back to this moment, like is Jimmy Doolittle young? Like, is he old enough to have been a Great War?
He's in his late 30s, early 40s, man.
I'm checking it right now.
Like too young to have served in the Great War.
Yeah, I don't think he was in the Great War, but he is. At a time, he came into the army at a time when like planes were becoming a little more.
Actually, he did see service in the Great War.
Okay, well then, never mind.
Shut the front door.
Shut me up.
I
don't know.
That's all right. He does see service in the Great War. He's born in 1896, and he is going to during the Great War. Honestly, he joined up with the United States Army Air Corps in 1918 and remained such until 1941.
Yep.
And then United States Army Air Force. From 41 to 47.
Yep. That's the abbreviation. And that's another thing about this mission.
Well, that's cool. We just learned that.
This is a joint military operation. So this is the Army and Navy working together. And of course, nothing went wrong with that. And they all got along swimmingly.
and this happened before Fredericksburg?
Yeah, of course. So Doolittle has 70 officers and 130 enlisted men under his command. They are part of the 17th Bombardment Group. They're loaded onto the USS Hornet, along with 16 B-25 Mitchell medium bombers at Almeida Air Station in San Diego on April 1st, 1942. So just a few days before the surrender at Bataan, they're getting loaded onto ships. So the plan was to launch the bombers at least 500 miles off the coast of the Japanese home islands and strike at major cities such as Tokyo, Yokohama, Nagoya, Kobe, and Osaka. But the raid's going to begin on April 18th, 1942. B-25s are going to take off from the Hornet, and they're going to be each carrying a one-ton payload to their targets. So I don't know a lot about bombing. It's light, because obviously medium bombers, but it's enough to leave a dent if you can hit your target.
Is Kyoto off the target Kyoto list at this moment the same way it is never, in a few years?
It's never going to be on the target
because list. Because it is the...
They realize it's an ancient...
The ancient
city of...
Symbolic capital city.
I think the Meiji Empire. Like, they knew it dated back at least to that, and they had that much resilience. So they do not select Kyoto as a target.
Well, that's... I mean, like, we kept a reverence for their historic capital, I believe. Kyoto, I think, is the historic capital.
Yeah.
Avery, have you seen the film footage of the launch of the Doolittle? Little raid,
like the actual reels.
Yeah, the reels.
Yeah, it's crazy,
isn't it?
Yeah,
how much so the Hornet is pitching and yawing.
So yeah, the Hornet is also in really rough seas at this point, and the fact that you're able to launch a B-25 at all off carry had never been done before. Everyone's saying this is a crazy idea. It's not going to work. while each of the planes get off the deck. They also had to launch further out because they were spotted by Japanese fishermen, civilians, who at first glance thought, oh, those are our ships. Because there's no way there'd be American aircraft carriers.
Do they have a radio on their ship?
They did. So by the time, and here's the crazy thing.
Just fly out there.
So they realize it's not fishermen. They realize it's not Japanese aircraft because not Japanese ships because we opened fire on them.
Of course.
We can't hit this ship. It's a little itty bitty Japanese wooden fishing boat and nobody can hit it. Nobody on the USS Hornet, none of the support ships. No one can hit this.
Did anybody put Bruno Guido in a rear gun and just point him at this thing? Because he could hit anything.
God damn. They did not. I'm going to ignore that.
Power through, Avery. Power through.
But, you know, B-25s, very interestingly, it mirrors Pearl Harbor because as soon as the B-25s appear over their targets on the Japanese home islands, Japanese civilians are going to think, oh, those are our planes. So they can't be.
Right, because Japan can't be touched like this.
Exactly.
Like that. Yeah.
And Japanese government is going to downplay the damage and the decisiveness of the American raid. But it's very clear after these bombs drop and hit most of their targets, it's clear that this is a psychological victory for the Americans. Because now Japan is no longer untouchable. They're no longer invincible.
One lands in the presidential palace grounds, I thought.
No, well, the bomb.
Not presidential.
The bomb goes off nearby.
Well, that's what I thought, like on the grounds. I thought one landed in the property of the palace grounds.
Yeah, they weren't trying to hit the palace itself because that's another thing we were also considering is like we don't want to kill the emperor either. Like, you know,
right. Like
we knew that by killing him, that would probably be the worst thing we could do.
Yeah, but I think one lands in like a courtyard on the property. Oh, yeah, no, it's like really
he
close.
Feels it. He feels this raid for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, the 88 Americans who flew the mission, only 4 were killed. Of the remaining 76, 8 were captured by Japanese forces on mainland China, which means all 16 B-25s escaped Japanese airspace and all run out of fuel once they reach China, and they all crash land, like pretty much. They just come in and...
I do like that scene in the new Midway where Aaron Eckhart, Doolittle, is like, he's like, so we're going to probably have to ditch in the South China Sea. Yeah. And it's like a real matter of fact. It's like, so that's just going
to
happen.
Yeah. Yep. As far as I know, according to ENW Toll, all those bombers make it at least to land. So nobody has to ditch it.
How far out are we? Too far.
That's
like all he says. Too far.
And then, you know, right when everything seemed lost, they were like, I see the coast. Yeah. I see China. It's probably the happiest.
Who's the better Doolittle, Alec Baldwin or Aaron Eckhart?
Oh, I love Baldwin, man. I'm sorry. I know everyone kind of canceled him, but he made a really good Doolittle.
I couldn't care less. I don't even want to talk about the modern Baldwin canceling, as a Doolittle.
I like him better than Eckhart. I'm sorry.
I mean, Eckhart was a strong Doolittle.
Eckhart's a strong Doolittle. I'll give him that. But something about Baldwin's like, you know, kind of.
Because that's what you want Doolittle to be.
Yeah.
You want Jimmy Doolittle to be that.
Jimmy Doolittle to be just, I'm going to smack this plane into so many freaking military centers and kills many of those bastards. I'm like, okay, all right, Alec,
take it down a notch.
Calm down. But yeah, no, it is a success, and all the Doolittle's raiders receive medals and are lauded as heroes by the American people who are starving for victory.
Yeah.
So morale goes right back up. At this point, something also very important is happening. We are starting to get really good at code breaking, and by really good, I mean like first time we've actually cracked a code. This is intense because one of the most critical aspects of the Pacific War is going to be our ability to crack the Japanese codes, specifically the Japanese naval codes. The place where that magic is happening is Station Hypo. Now, you just watched Midway. So one of the guys at Station Hypo is Edwin Layton, who's played by Patrick Wilson in the film.
Right.
He works under Paul Rochefort, or not Paul, Joseph Rochefort. There's a different Paul.
Is that
Rochefort.
The bathrobe guy?
Yeah. No, I don't know.
I think that's the bathrobe and slippers guy.
Commander Joseph Rochefort. It's probably Rochefort or something like that. But he is in charge of Fleet Radio Unit Pacific, or FRUPAC. One thing that I love about the Pacific Theater is all the acronyms. They're so colorful. You got SYNCPAC, FRUPAC.
I could go for a fruit pack right now. I'm not going to lie.
And yeah, the men under this command are going to be in charge of breaking the Japanese codes via a mind-numbing Sisyphean campaign to decipher 50,000 five-digit numerical groups.
Woo.
One of the men at Station Hypo, Edwin Layton, he's going to be one of the first to crack this code. He actually is running point on it. So it's the men of Station Hypo that are going to discover in the spring of 1942, Japanese Navy is on the move and they have targets. So there will be two offensives we have to prep for. There will be an attempt by Yamamoto to strike the island of Midway, which is halfway between Japan and Hawaii. And so striking at Midway, it's a good name for the island.
When it's Midway.
Solid.
And so taking out Midway is going to give them a launch point to maybe invade Hawaii. So we need to protect Midway at all costs. Another offensive the Japanese Navy is planning is going to be aimed at Port Moresby on New Guinea.
Mm.
You take Port Moresby, you can potentially use that as a staging area for the potential invasion of mainland Australia. Again, why would I want to do that? I don't know. So yeah, you're looking at your maps, you can see Midway out here beyond that line of occupation. You also see Port Moresby in the blue at the bottom of New Guinea. It's not on the map there, but basically on the right little leg of New Guinea is where Port Moresby would have
been.
So
we're still on our cover sheet. So yeah,
you're on your cover sheet. These are where the Japanese are aimed at. My fingers are on it. And so with these two offensives, that's how we learn where the Japanese naval fleets will be. We need to get there and intercept them. We have an opportunity to strike a blow to the Japanese naval power. So this kicks off two major naval campaigns. First is going to be the Coral Sea campaign of May of 1942. Chester Nimitz is going to issue this plan on April 28th. It's going to comprise of the USS Yorktown's carrier group. That's Task Force 17 under Vice Admiral Frank Jack Fletcher, and the USS Lexington's carrier group, which is Task Force 11 under Vice Admiral Aubrey Fitch. They're going to arrive in Coral Sea just in time to intercept and attack the Japanese invasion fleet. Also, the Allied fleet's going to be comprised of ANZAC, Australian and New Zealand forces of cruisers, all under Fletcher's command. They're going up against Vice Admiral Shigeyoshi Inoue, commanding the Japanese Fourth Fleet, with Vice Admiral Takeo Takagi commanding the carrier strike force.
You got it.
And so the Japanese strike groups, they're going to hit Tulagi and other targets in the Solomon Island chain. You can see that in blue. They're off the coast of New Guinea. They're also going to be hitting positions around Rabaul, and they're going to occupy Rabaul and New Britain. I know. And they are going to basically attack towards Port Moresby. Also included in this campaign, Vice Admiral Chuichi Nagumo. He's a carrier group commander who's led the way at Pearl Harbor. He had had his carriers covering an expanse of more than 50,000 miles.
Wow.
From Hawaii to the east, all the way to Ceylon in the west. And that's almost a third of the planet's surface, people. That's an incredible amount of area to cover.
I forgot that Ceylon hadn't been... Is it renamed now?
It probably is. I don't know where it is. I just know it's to the other side of...
Well, because think about Johnny, I Hardly Knew You. Like, I in my brain, I'm hearing Dropkick Murphys version of that song. Sure, but, yeah. Like, they reference that island, and I'm always like, where the hell is that?
Yeah. So, I mean, if we wanted to take a moment, we can take a little breather before I dive deep into this. I'm not going to go too deep. I know I kind of got sidetracked on that, but needless to say, this battle, without going into much detail, it is a very high physical demand on both carrier groups. Japanese forces are going to divide into smaller sections, meaning that the imposing forces in Coral Sea are going to be nearly equal in strength. USS Lexington, probably one of my favorite carriers, affectionately named Lady Lex, is the largest carrier in the U.S. fleet, roughly 60 to 70 feet longer than both the Enterprise, Yorktown, and Hornet. So wow. All three of them.
Hell yeah.
And the span of the days of battle are going to be from May 1st to the 8th, 1942. Something about the beginning of May and just fighting at the start of that month. Because, man, we did it in the Civil War. We're going to do it in World War II. And so weather is cold and rainy. There are high swells on May 2, on 2nd and 3rd especially. Overall, these fleets are never going to see each other. This is the first naval battle in world history where neither fleet lays eyes on each other, but they're solely spotted by their aircraft. Quickly, the results of this, there is going to be Japanese ships sunk, one of which is a light carrier by the name of Shoho. It was the first Japanese ship sunk in the war by us, by the Americans. And,
wait, not the ships we blasted off of Wake Island?
Well, major ships.
Okay.
So those were like support ships. This is an actual carrier.
Okay.
So,
I just wanted to say, like, I was like, wait a minute.
This is a.
Yeah. Okay. You know, this is like a major league ship.
This is like a dude that's jacked. We smacked him in the face.
Yeah. Okay. Bro.
So we say this make the Shoho, which is a smaller carrier.
It's really weird when you go blue culture. It's like not who you are.
I know. And so unfortunately, Japanese carrier aircraft scored some hits. They sank the USS Neosho, which was a oil tanker, and then a destroyer USS Sims. And then on the 8th, they found a third victim, which of course was the Lady Lex.
Lex.
Oh, your girl.
Yeah, my girl went down. She was
not in the good way.
But
did you can't? You can't just,
no,
you
we'll
just,
be right back.
You can't just tee it up for me.
No. But nevertheless, the aggressive Allied presence in the Coral Sea is enough to deter the Japanese fleet, so they leave Port Moresby for another day. Right. And their invasion of Australia is postponed, and most of their forces withdraw back towards the Solomon Islands and New Britain. And so, for now, Australia is safe from Japanese invasion, but they're not out of the woods yet. That's going to be decided in the upcoming campaign in the Solomon Islands at an island called Guadalcanal.
And I can't wait to get to that conversation, Matt. That conversation about Guadalcanal and part two and the rest of the war in the Pacific is going to happen when?
The next week.
The next week. So we are going to be cutting this one up. This is a juggernaut of behemoth. You're used to us doing behemoth offerings. And most times we'll give you that historical cheeseburger and we'll shove it down your throat in one bite. Hmm. But this is a subject that got even bigger than we were anticipating, and we were so excited for it that we decided that it's probably best to break it up a little bit, and yep. We're going to do that for you. So as Matty B said, tune in next Monday to get part two of this epic conversation about World War II, the war in the Pacific, with special guest Avery Lentz. Follow us on our social medias at the History Things Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And if you're looking to help the show, as always, we thank you to those that decide to do so. We appreciate it immensely. You can do so by going where, Matt?
To any of your favorite podcast apps, leaving us a 5-star review or rating.
Yeah, make sure you share the love. We spread the love, you share the love, and all of us just getting down with history together. So for Avery Lentz, our special guest today, for my co-host with the most, Matty B, Matt Borders, I'm your co-host, Pat McGuire. This has been part one of our epic conversation, our overview on World War II in the Pacific. This has been the History Things Podcast, saying we'll catch you all later!
See you next week!